Now we'll go to the two other bills which we had previously mentioned in the meeting. We've also been referred to this committee and referred in the course of last week. Two additional bills have been referred to this committee for consideration. I might just add, these bills are not very expensive, and so I don't think they should cause any worry to us. We have, in fact, agreed that we would accommodate these two bills in the existing program. So without delaying matters, allow me to invite, I'm not sure if it's Advocate or Mr. Lorenzo from the Minister's Department, to give us a 10-minute presentation on the bill. Over to you, Ms. Lorenzo.
Thanks very much. Good morning, members. I'm going to give you a presentation on the bill that was certified by the state law advisors. I know that the state law advisors are here this morning, and they're going to highlight the changes that they made in the certification process. But I think it's important at this stage that I say that there have been two versions of the bill to date. The one is the version that was approved by Cabinet on the 5th of March. And that was published for comments and gazetted. And then, following the certification process, the state law advisors made certain changes, and that bill was also published. When the committee has its public hearings, the comments will be as a result of that bill. So I can just highlight some of the changes, but I'll leave that to the state law advisors to do in detail.
1 minute. I see hands up here. Dr. Quellen.
I think we have to be clear what is going to be presented, because we don't want to go back to what happened last week. Last week we were presented with from the minutes with something which we were not sure what it is. I think let's focus to shape it on the deal before the committee. Otherwise we'll continue to have confusion. If the advisor from the minutes say is presenting the, I thought your request was to make presentation a short summary on what they are presenting to us, which is Bill 28 of 208. But if we talk of different versions of the bill, the only version we have now is this one. That's the only version which is before the committee. That's what our first appeal that we focus on.
Thank you. My request is very similar on my first point, and that is we need to set out now that we are working with a specific bill before us. And that is all we want to be briefed on. If the state law advisors are of the opinion that something was changed, we do not need to have information about the previous bill. All they need to say is, this was changed and we think the bill before us maybe need to be amended to recapture that or something like that. But see, we can't spend time with what happened in the past. This is what was tabled in Parliament. That's what we have to deal with. And the only input we need is explanatory or what recommendations about possible amendments. And the same question, Chair. Last week we had a comprehensive briefing with explanatory notes from a person representing the ministry. We went to the whole bill with us. We spent the whole morning with that. I just need some clarity as to the fine if Corenza is going to add on to that or highlight certain things to summarize that. But if I look at this document that's before me, I presume this is yours because it's not marked on the Ministry's Data Protection Information. This is your document. I look at this, and this is very much along the same lines than what we had last week. So I just don't think in terms of time we need to repeat of that. So just some explanation if I'm totally wrong in what I'm arguing or not.
Anybody else? Uh, The Honourable Minka Patel.
Thank you. I just want to second vote, but apparently the first suggestion, let's deal with the bill. Anything should add into that. Really and truly, this is a nice exercise. Let's do it while we're still having energy. Thank you.
Thank you, Minka Patel. I think that Mr. Renzo is aware of what was expected from the Minister today. I think she was merely highlighting some of the issues as an introduction. I think it's quite clear in our correspondence that we wanted the presentation on the bill that is before the committee, so I don't think that we are out of tune with the department. I also discussed just before the meeting what it was we expected. I in fact made it quite clear to her that we wanted a 10-minute presentation on the existing bill as it is. And I think she was merely trying to clarify some of the historical events that led up to what we are dealing with. Over to you again, Dan.
Yes, thank you. And what I'm presenting on is the bill that is before the committee. I just wanted to say one thing, though, if I may, that there was a letter that was sent to the minister, requesting the minister to clarify the status of last week's presentation, specifically in relation to the explanatory notes, and asking the minister to confirm whether or not some of the changes that have been suggested have been accepted. Now that's why I started off with the process, because when the bill was initially adopted by cabinet, it was published for comment. And what the drafting team did, of which Advocate Howard Varney was a member of the drafting team, is we summarized those submissions and summarized what some of the recommended changes were for the purposes of assisting the committee. The minister's asked me to clarify and just to place on record that at this stage, he is not in a position to say, I accept this suggestion, I don't accept that suggestion, and I hope that the revised document that I circulated makes it very clear where the minister is inclined to accept some of the recommendations, and where the minister is saying that the committee needs to decide, because ultimately it's in the process of the public hearing that the committee will decide. So at this stage, the only version of the bill that is on the table is the version that was certified by the state law advisors. To the extent that the committee wants any kind of discussion or clarification on what our view is on what some of the suggestions have been, we are willing to provide that. But in the end, it's going to be the committee that's going to make those decisions.
Sorry, just the Honourable Landers' point of clarification.
No, I just thought I'd want to make this point that this bill now in our hands, and what went before, we can be provided with for purposes of our information, informing us. I feel very uncomfortable when we start asking the minister, well, look, did you accept this? Because it's not only in his hands now, it's in our hands. For us to decide, and whether he's accepted or not, is now a matter for us to debate and decide upon. Of course, we can still ask them, are you happy with this? And perhaps engage them. And even there, we need to be very careful as to how we do it. So Chair, I think in that regard, Corinne is quite correct. Insofar as we want information, well, if the state law advisor changed something, we can ask them, why did you change this for purposes of our information? If we're not happy with it, then we can decide how we're going to proceed from there.
The Honourable Bloom?
No, I agree with what Mr. Landers has said. I have said it last week, that this bill is in our hands, and we must decide. You see, side submissions and what to the minister must come to this committee now, because we are dealing now with it. The minister has introduced the bill to Parliament, and it's in front of us, and we must decide what to do.
I think it's important that we have to clarify for the minister, because because it's a minister who tables the bill. But the presentation last week, we're not sure whether the minister is proposing change. Because if the minister is proposing changes on the bill he's putting before the committee, there must be a separate process. And that's what I think was requested from the minister, separate those issues. Secondly, the presentation last week, we're not sure on whose behalf was that presentation and opinion. Because some of the presentation, it was like a personal opinion of the presenter. So that's why the things have to be clarified, otherwise it becomes confusing whether the minister is proposing changes on the bill before even considering. I think that's why it was then important to clarify those matters. But when we consider the bill, we look at this bill, and we put a separate process, what are the further proposals and changes from the minister? I think that was an attempt to clarify, other than saying we're putting back the bill to the minister. Otherwise, if you don't clarify those issues, those documents are with the members now. And then when we're considering the bill, we'd like to know the status of those documents which are presented. Otherwise, we may be considering the things which have got no status as a committee. So it was at least as far as we are shifting our things as we move forward. Thank you.
I'll be very quick. I've been greatly clarified by Caleb. But I want to make it a very easy question. And it's not about the personal opinion, whatever. This document, we briefed on this document. I found it a very informative document. I want to know this specific document that we got last week. Was that the official document that came from the ministry and from the drafting team to be put before us? And that's all. If it's not the case, then we know how to evaluate what happened last week.
But I think in light of some of the confusion that arose, specifically the issue about what is the status of the recommendation, I think I've clarified that and I submitted a new document which makes it absolutely clear that what we're simply doing is summarizing all the submissions to date for the purposes of the committee. We are providing our opinion where we think it's relevant to say, well, this suggestion doesn't necessarily alter the objects of the bill as approved by Cabinet, or in this case, we think it does. But I think we make it very clear in this document that ultimately, it's really for the committee to decide on how to evaluate these submissions. I know the committee has scheduled time for public hearings, and many of the people that made submissions to the ministry, which we did forward to the committee, I should imagine, would make the similar kinds of submissions to the committee, and it's really meant to be a guide. So I hope that it's clarified, and I apologize for any of the confusion that may have arisen.
Point of clarification, Ms. Karenda. Shall we then, there are three of these documents coming from the minister, the what's the name, that's explanatory notes. They've got different dates. The latest one, I think, is dated the 10th, 13th. Shall we accept that the one of the 13th is all inclusive and that we can ignore the other two?
Yes.
For the sake of confusion now, because it's very difficult to go through the three documents and see where they differ from each other. Is it from the ministry's position that the last document is the one in which
Yes, Chairperson. It's a revised. I mean, all it does is it makes it absolutely clear. So whereas the other document said it is proposed, we have said public submissions have said. I just simply tried to clarify the language to take into account some of the confusion that arose. So the document that is the consolidation of the summary of the submissions and our view on what those submissions are is the document that was circulated. It's dated the 13th of June.
So we can ignore the other two?
Yeah.
No, Chairperson, again, public submissions are supposed to come to this committee and not to the minister. And then we will deal with public submissions. The minister introduced the bill to Parliament. When there is public submission, then we are dealing with public submissions.
I clarify that, Chairperson? Because the submissions that have been made to date have been submissions that have been made by the Minister's Review Commission on Intelligence. I think that was forwarded to the committee. It was also posted on our website. And then also we have responded as the drafting team to some of the newspaper articles, specifically public statements that have been made by various journalists. So we haven't entertained those public submissions. We understand that that process has to be managed by the committee.
The Honourable Ngapateli.
Thank you, sir. Maybe you can help us to redefine or revise the role of the committee, so that we don't find ourselves duplicating. What are we supposed to do? What is the job description of this committee? And, yeah, because I'm getting a little bit of a confusion. Are submissions done through the chair of the ad hoc committee, honorable measures, or they're done somewhere else? If they're done somewhere else, which ones would be sent somewhere else and which ones would be sent in? And what is the actual role of this committee so that we really don't find ourselves at look ahead?
Honourable members, I'm just worried that we're spending a lot of time on this issue. Really, this is a committee issue. Surely this document, if it is, as some of you are suggesting, a document that should not be considered by the committee, that can consider that timelessly by ourselves. I don't think we need to debate this issue with the ministry. The document is in the committee's hands. I think at some stage or another we'll sit down as a committee and consider the document and the status of the document. I don't know how the committee feels about that.
I think to clarify the matter, the bill has been referred to the committee, bill number 28 of 2008, this one. Got explanatory memorandum on page 26, 27, and 28. And there's another explanatory note, if I understand well, which were compiled by the ministry, to take into account their initial responses to some of the submissions. And this is basically not the deadline now, which also talks to this memorandum. So those are the two documents which are separate, but basically what we are considering is the bill as a committee. That's what we expected to focus on, consideration of the bill. As we move, we will consult, as Mr. Landers has said, we will consult with the ministry whether what their views on some of these things. I think they gave us their initial views on some of those things. I think it should just be for notice at this stage. We're not considering this. That's not what is put for us to have to consider. It's just their initial views from the minister from what has been coming out at the moment. That's my understanding. But what is minister presented to us on this? Thank you.
Honorable
Abraham
and then
prior to the bill having been tabled in Parliament for consideration by whatever committee, I get the sense here that there have been submissions on the bill prior. Now I find there's been comment or whatever. Has the ministry provided all the submissions or comments that they had received on the bill to us? If not, Chair, then of course what stands to reason is that we have called for submissions. We will then only be able to consider the submissions that have been sent to us. But I think it would be helpful if the Ministry is willing to make available whatever submissions they have had. It may be helpful to us. So I merely want to ask whether we have received the submissions that were sent to the minister prior to the tabling of the bill, and whether they've received anything after the tabling of the bill, and whether those submissions have been made available to us. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Abram, I don't want to confront you on the issues now.
But I think
the We are dealing with two separate processes here, you know, one from the executive and one from the legislature. There's clearly a separation of powers here. The bill before the executive would have encouraged presentations which would have influenced the changing of the wording of the bill in the hands of the executive. And I think that is their process. The bill now, in our hands, is a different process. I think the committee need to note your suggestion that, you know, we might need or at some time look at those presentations. I mean, that's something the committee would need to decide. But I don't think it would be appropriate for the ministry now to pass on, you know, their process to us and start confusing the two status of the different arms of government. Do we need to, is there still something more to be said on this thing? Mr. Bloom, I see you.
No, Chair, I beg to differ with what you were saying to Mr. Abrams' thing. When this bill, has been adopted and accepted by Cabinet, it's there. All, with all submissions and everything, it's there. The Cabinet accepted the bill as is, not after the Cabinet has, and then the submission.
Thank you. I'll
help you by saying that what is required from us to consider this deal and the submission which we made to the public to the committee. The minister has done that assistance. If we ask them to bring us the submission to the ministry, we would be really resenting the process. Because some of those submissions may become irrelevant because things have changed. So I won't really go to extend to say we request them to give their submission because the bill has changed from what it was originally was. And we'd be really starting the process which doesn't belong to us. With us, we've got many submissions and many are still coming on the 20th. I think let's focus on that so that we don't have a... Actually, if you check some of the submissions, they are confusing precisely because of that. They are referring to the deal which is not in front of the committee. And we don't want to add to that confusion. Let's see those submissions when we come to, because there's a lot of enthusiasm, and they consider this deal. So I support what you're saying.
Mr. Abram, I think at some stage or another, the committee has got the power to consider what it wants to do. And if it's still your view at some time that the committee should consider that, then we shall obviously entertain it. But I think members, can we now proceed and get to this bill, this 10-minute presentation? I think we understand each other, Ms. Carenzo, that we want to deal with the bill that is before the committee and the presentation just on that bill. 10 minutes, and then we'll take presentation from the state law advisor, and then we'll go into questions. Thank you.
Thank you. If I'm going over anything that has that the committee is already familiar with, that please just indicate, and I'll skip it. The Protection of Information Bill, the objective of the bill is to set up a statutory framework for the protection of state information, to articulate criteria, guidelines, and processes for the protection from destruction and or disclosure of state information, to put in place criteria and processes for classification and declassification, very importantly, declassification, and to put in place certain offences and sentences for espionage, and in particular
Before that, we had another briefing which I think is more interesting. So that was my initial remarks about why we're having another briefing. I understand that why Ms. Quenza is here is to add on to what we had last week, not to repeat what we had last week. That's my remarks.
With respect, I think it's what I have addressed the committee on what we would expect from Ms. Carenzo, and that was a 10-minute briefing on the bill. I think we leave it up to the ministry to decide what aspects of the bill they regard as important, which they want to present. We're not expecting them to give an extensive presentation on the bill. So it's quite a big bill, so I think it's up to Ms. Carenzo to decide which aspects they want to raise in the committee, and I think that's precisely what she's doing. So we'll get 10 minutes off.
Can I?
I see some hands here now. Is this really necessary?
I think it is important for Carenzo to make a summary of the appeal. Because, I'll tell you why, because maybe if we don't, because we may say we're repeating this. Last week we were told that there are substantive changes by state law advisors. So I'm going to go to the state law advisors and see those substantive changes. So we appeal that let's let us go through the bill as quick as we can, just 10 minutes, because we're all familiar with the framework. And so we're going to go to the next agenda, we can clearly delineate this issue. But I feel that we'll allow it to speak as much as you can.
Thank you for that support. So the honourable members, please try and contain themselves for 10 minutes and give this a presentation. And after that, we will deal with, you know, whether the presentation was relevant or not.
I'll speak as quickly as I can. I do think that I probably would be going over some ground. So I was asked to give a briefing on the bill. I'll give a briefing on the bill, mindful of the fact that you probably have already dealt with much of the detail. So I think the objectives of the bill are clear. I think that was made very clear. I think that you also have been briefed on what the existing protection regime is and the problems with the existing legislation and the existing regulatory framework. I don't think I need to go into details there. And also what informed the questions that the drafting team was asking in relation to developing a new classification and legislative framework. As far as the preamble of the bill, again, the preamble of the bill is just to set out the very broad aims of the bill. I think that is clear. There has been a recommendation from the Ministerial Review Commission that is published on the website that there needs to be changes in the language in the preamble. The explanatory notes summarize that. That's for the committee to decide. I'll go through the chapters very briefly now. The first chapter deals with the definitions, objects, and application of the bill. Just to say that the bill applies to all organs of state, except that the minister may exempt, on good cause, certain departments or bodies of state from complying with the bill, specifically in relation to setting up departmental processes and procedures. This has also been criticized in some of the submissions that have been made, basically saying that why would the minister want to exempt government departments. I think our intention behind this was actually to prevent overclassification, because there shouldn't be government departments that don't deal with sensitive information shouldn't have to classify. So that's one area that I'd like to alert the committee to. Just as far as the Chapter 2 deals with the nature and the general principles of information, we define information is. The state law advisor will deal with the changes that were made between the original bill that was adopted by Cabinet and this bill on the table, and that is about information. The original bill, as you know, dealt with information in non-material form. State law advisors took that out. They said that constitutionally it was too difficult to enforce. So at the moment, the information that is protected is information that is valuable or classified. So information that is valuable is information that is protected from destruction, alteration or loss, and then information that is classified protected from disclosure. Clause 7 of the bill and Clause 8 of the bill just set out the principles that underpin the law and inform its implementation and interpretation. I don't think I need to go into that. Chapter 3 deals with the National Information Security Standards and Departmental Policies and Procedures. It simply defines the role of the minister and the role of the department, says that the minister needs to set national guidelines, the department needs to set departmental policies and procedures. I think that's very uncontroversial. I don't need to go into the detail of that. Chapter 4 deals with the criteria and the principles that would inform whether or not a decision is made to protect against alteration, destruction, or loss. Really, what informs a decision about whether or not something is valuable? And then also how the valuable information is to be protected. Chapter 5, which deals with protection against disclosure. What this chapter does is it defines different categories of information: sensitive, commercial, and personal information. Sensitive information is information that must be protected to prevent the national interest of the Republic being endangered. There have been certain recommendations that is too wide. That is something that the committee is going to have to decide whether or not the definition of national interest and the categories that need to be protected of disclosure, whether or not the language needs to be reworked there to prevent unintended consequences. So we have three types of information: personal information, commercial information, and sensitive information. Your presentation actually highlights. The presentation actually highlights and summarizes what is contained in your explanatory notes about what some of the concerns have been publicly. I won't go into that. I think that's merely to act as a guide to the committee should you want to take those things into account. And then the following chapter, Chapter 6, deals with classification of information. We have, as I said, we have three types of information: personal, commercial, and sensitive. And within that, we have three types of classification: confidential, secret, or top secret. The only category of information that does not have a confidential classification is personal information. As I explained in initial briefings to the JSC, and also to this committee, that initially we had extended the protection of confidential to personal information, but in the consultation process, the drafting team was persuaded to remove that because there is a task team that is dealing with privacy legislation that is managed by the Law Commission, and they felt that the ambit of this legislation was not on privacy. There's other legislation to protect privacy. Again, that has been raised as an issue. Ultimately, the committee will have to decide whether or not to extend the protection of personal information. So I don't think I'll go through the actual detail of how we've defined secret, top secret, and confidential. That is set out in the legislation. In addition, the bill deals with who has the authority to classify information. I think the point here is that we are trying to make it clear that a decision to classify information, a decision to withhold access, shouldn't be an arbitrary one. It needs to be a considered one, because the presumption is that all information should be available and accessible unless it needs to be protected. And it needs to be protected on this basis. I just want to highlight your attention to the second last bullet point. There's a provision that we can classify items, files or integral file blocks, basically categories of information. So that if there was a specific project that was deemed to be secret or top secret or confidential, then for the purposes of that exercise, one could say everything related to that particular project should be classified. I think that is something that the committee is going to have to consider, because that has been criticized. People have journalists, when they've been writing about this, have said that that would lead to some kind of a de facto blanket classification. That was not our intention. But again, I think we are eager to avoid unintended consequences. All right, principles of classification. I think the point here is that, and we've made it expressly in the bill, that classification of information actually needs to protect the national interest. Secrecy exists to protect the national interest, and it can't be used to conceal an unlawful act or incompetence or inefficiency or administrative error. There is a clause in the bill that deals with the report and return of classified records. I think this is very controversial. It simply says that if you're in possession of documents that you know are classified, you need to return them. Declassification, again, what the bill does is it sets out the process for declassification. The one area that I'd like to draw the committee's attention to is the clause 33, which states that all classified information that was classified on or before the 10th of May 1994 shall be automatically declassified unless reclassified in terms of this bill. I think the point here is that that does not mean that all information that was classified before 1994 automatically declassified. It simply means that if you want to retain its classification, it has to actually comply with the principles in this bill. The bill also deals with the bill also deals with maximum protection periods, criteria to protect information for longer than 20 years, longer than 30 years. We did benchmark these provisions against. We looked at international legislation. This, I think, will generate quite a lot of debate, because many people, especially the freedom of expression people, are saying that really is there a need to protect information for longer than 30 years, and that's why we've said that for information to be protected for longer than 30 years, there actually needs to be demonstrable life-threatening or physical harm to a person. Criteria for the continued classification of information. Yeah, we've simply said that when you are deciding after the initial classification period whether or not information should be classified, these are the criteria that you'd consider. And you would have noticed that the criteria here are slightly higher than the decision that would have informed the original classification. And that is because we think that a decision to extend classification, there needs to be additional reasons why. The bill also requires government departments to conduct regular reviews of the classified status of information, and to make that information that has been declassified available on the National Declassification Database. The bill also has a provision which allows government departments to establish their own processes and procedures to make available declassified information to the public. There is one area that I'd like to alert the committee to, and that is the requirement in the last bullet point that we need to limit the provision for confirming whether or not information does exist to information that deals with top secret information. In some instances, the fact that something exists may be classified itself. I think when we were drafting, possibly as an unintended consequence. So that has been one of the suggestions. As far as the appeal procedure. If a member of the public brings an application for in access to information, and that document is classified, the person considering that application would automatically review the classification status of that document. It's in this way that we try to align the provisions of this bill with the provisions in the promotion of access to information. Because at the moment what happens is that if there is an access for a request for access to information for a classified document, automatically the person considering that denies access. So we've said that if you make an application for access to classified documents, the classification needs to be reviewed. The bill contains an appeal procedure. It would go up to the minister of that particular department. This is a provision of the bill that has been criticised. I think I've gone in the explanatory notes into what the criticisms are. And really they relate to the absence of an independent oversight mechanism. Chapter 8 deals with transfer of the records to the National Archives, I think very basic, very standard. Chapter 9 deals with release of declassified information to the public. It sets out the basis on which members of the public can access information. We have made some references to this particular provision in the explanatory notes. The one thing that the committee may wish to do is to have this legislation, once it's passed, listed in the schedule of the PIA Act, simply to make it clear that departments would be able to have their own processes and procedures for making information available to the public. What has been pointed out to us is that possibly PIA is sometimes used as a default, and that actually PIA does contemplate departments having internal processes and mechanisms to release information, and that not every application for access to information has to be made in terms of PIA, that sometimes that is unduly bureaucratic, and that a way to make that absolutely clear would be to ensure that it's listed in the schedule of PIA. It is something that we raised with the stakeholder advisors in the certification process, but as they pointed out to us, they can't list the bill in the schedule of PIA until the bill is actually passed. So it's just, I think, to note that for the committee. Chapter 10 deals with implementation of monitoring, sets out the obligations of the National Intelligence Agency to exercise oversight, to provide training. This chapter has been criticised again because it doesn't make provision for an independent oversight mechanism. I think, as has been explained in previous briefings to the committee, the original draft that went to cabinet included a provision for the establishment of an independent oversight mechanism. That was not adopted by cabinet. It was a concern that it was creating an unduly bureaucratic and administrative structure, and that for the next 5 years, really the priority of government departments is going to be to establish their own internal policies and procedures and to actually audit and declassify the information. I think the explanatory notes do go into some detail about what the criticisms have been there. Ultimately, I think it's going to be for the committee to decide whether or not you want to reintroduce the provision of an independent oversight mechanism. Chapter 11 deals with offences and penalties. I think those are pretty standard. To highlight the crime of information peddling, that it is an offence to knowingly supply incorrect information to the national intelligence structures. The one recommendation that has been made specifically by journalists and is discussed in the explanatory notes is that perhaps one needs to consider a public interest exemption clause for some of the technical offences. I think I have gone into that in some detail before. I don't necessarily need to repeat that. I think the explanatory notes do cover what if the committee were to accept that as a recommendation, what such a public exemption clause could look like. I think it's important though to be clear about how such an exemption clause is drafted. because I think the one issue, and this was really reaffirmed in the Constitutional Court judgment, in the independent media and the Minister of Intelligence that dealt with the right of the media to access confidential information, is that there is no automatic right to access to information. That really one is dealing with two equal rights, that depending on the circumstances and the appropriateness, you need to really decide each case on the merits. That there is no right, automatic right to access to information. That the state in certain circumstances has a right to restrict access to information, as long as those decisions are rationally based and informed by the Constitution and not arbitrary. And I think the challenge is that the media would want to assert this, what they refer to as this open democracy right. And I think that's going to be an issue for consideration by the commission, by the committee. The Chapter 12 deals with the classified information in court proceedings. What we simply say here is that information that is classified, that is part of a court record, will retain its protected status unless a court orders otherwise. We have not removed the jurisdiction of the court to make the final decision. We're simply trying to enforce some kind of a procedure to prevent classified information from being inadvertently made available if it's part of court records. And I think that if you were to look at the judgment of the Constitutional Court case, you would see that really what we're proposing is in line with what the court was proposing.
Thank you, Ms. Kareta, for about 20 minutes.
Sorry.
Shall we then go over to the state law advisor as agreed, and then after that we'll take questions? Over to you. Am I correct in my analysis of the situation that there isn't a document available, but one will be made available to the committee?
Yes, sir.
Then proceed.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I must just apologize for what the Chair has just mentioned. I couldn't attend last week due to ill health. I think that was noted before the committee last week, and for that I apologize. And as for the confusion that must have been created as a result of that, I also apologize. I may start my presentation, which is just verbal, by stating how the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor operates. First and foremost, we received a draft from the... I'll just go briefly because I know the committee members are well aware of that. We received a draft from the department, which we also require a cabinet approval to see what the cabinet has approved in terms of policy. What I also want to highlight in our operation, that is in certifying the bill, we assist the department in trying to translate that policy into a legislation. So the drafting of that legislation was not presented to the cabinet. What the cabinet was presented with was just a policy. So drafting of that of policy into legislation is something else that was going to follow in the process of certification by the state law advisor in consultation with the department. So what we do, this is not the first time with the bill. All the bills are like that, as the members are aware of that process. In our certification process, we sort of advise the department how to craft a certain provision that is in a more simpler and understandable. But what we make sure is that cabinet policy that was approved by policy is not changed, and there must be no shift from what the cabinet has approved. That's what we embark on. So what I can just highlight, without going through the whole process, that is to save the members from saying, for instance, that we changed an ease and changed in May to March, all those things that in Atrophet are also in the in process of certification. The bill that was presented to us for certification, yes, which in actual fact I verify each and every step with the department that through Karenza. And I highlighted those things that I sort of changed, we recommended in our office that must be inserted in red. What are those things that are not clear, I highlighted for her attention to see if they are blue, or those that I recommend that must be removed in yellow. So that was the language that we used in communicating, that is in the process of drafting the legislation that is now the bill before the committee. So my duty here before the committee is to clarify what are those changes and give motivation, if I heard correctly from you, Chair. I tend to be guided by you, Chair. As I said earlier on, I won't go through the minor things. I will just emphasize what we changed as the former Chapter 7, which is, it was, I don't think it is in the bill. It is on the bill that, the draft bill that was presented to committee, which Karenza earlier on mentioned on the designation of information. That we discussed with the department that that one will be impossible to enforce. Since it is the information that is not material, for the department, how are they going to protect that information? Because the information is, to protect that information, you have to sort of categorize it and classify it as a top secret, confidential, and what. How are you going to mark that information if it is not material? So we agreed on that. At least at this stage, we remove that section from the bill. Another major is the transitional, on the transitional provision, whereby the bill, the original bill that was be sent to cabinet for approval, it has the sort of the on the transitional provision, some of the provisions were were going to be suspended, and others come immediately after the act comes into operation. What we said was that our point was that on the principle of legality, that will not be correct to say the offences when in actual fact the whole act is not in operation. So the best thing is to waive all the principle of legality, that the law must be known by people before you can say that okay, people have committed offense and you penalize them. So they must know the what is expected of them. So we say that we cannot say that these offenses take effect immediately after the act. So we agreed with the department, so the department was convinced to remove that from the transitional provision for principle of legality. Thank you. That is all.
Were there any sections where must was changed to may or may change to must? If there were a number of that, then I'd rather you just forward us the document in which you highlighted. If there weren't many of them, can you just draw the committee's attention to them? Because these must and may sometimes do make substantial changes to the bill, and so perhaps you can just, if there are those, some of those areas, just draw the committee's attention to them.
Okay, thank you, sir. It was just a sort of, I was mentioning what the things that I will not go through, those things that I think they are not that substantive. I'll just mention, it was just a question of mentioning things like may or must. I will not go through those things. But for what you say, I understand what you say, because there is a lot in may and the must. So those things, I will make them available, but they are not much on that. It's just a wording. There are changes that just a wording. For instance, I can just mention. Yeah, okay. The minister must on the chapter 3, national standards and procedure, clause 9.
Clause 9, subsection 1.
Yes, yeah, where it says the minister, it was shall. So we changed that to must. So those are the things.
That's one of the examples.
Yes.
But you will let us have your substantive notes on the all the changes that you've made.
Definitely.
Thank you so much. Members, there are the two presentations. I'm sure there are a number of questions. I recognize the Honorable.
I just want to reconfirm here, because you see, the impression given last week was the impression of two opinions. State law and other coming with a different view from what Minister wants. Am I correct that whatever changes they were made in consultation with the Minister, so we don't waste time in them? What did the State law advisor produced together with the ministry is this? Because there was an impression that this was not our deal. This thing was changed. We were not given explanation and all those. That's why I wanted this explanation. But if that's the case now, we know what we're dealing with. Is this, but we don't focus on other issues.
Thank you. Any other questions? I recognize the Honorable Abram. Anybody else?
Chair, I would just like to know from the state law advisors, in evaluating the bill that was presented to them, does their evaluation merely cover the basic legal paraphrasing, phrasing, wording of the bill? Or does it also cover the extent to which the bill is compliant with the constitution of the country, and then advise the executive accordingly? I would like to know whether that is part of the process that is undertaken by the state law advisor.
Are there any other questions? I see the Honorable
Quellen. Two minor things. I don't want to go to the substance of the state. The first one, last week we made a request to get some form of a broader quantification of the cost into ratification of the bill. I'm not sure whether that is read by now, because the bill just simply said there are no cost implications. All of us, even the panel, said there are cost implications. The other one, without going also into substantive discussion, what is usually protected by all particularly the intelligence agencies, the sources and the metal. And particularly the sources. Whether that particular issue of sources was just considered as broader protection of information, or there any specific consideration for that. I'm saying this because with a law like this, we are more likely to get defense. Was Mr. Bush an intelligence source of the mountain, for instance? You know, you can get that type of request coming now and again and say, come with a reason why he's not saying that. And whether, what was the principle? Because we've got this 30-year obligation, whether there was any special consideration of that. I'm not worried about metal. Because methods, you can say that method is old now, there's no need to. But it's an issue of sources. And in particular to the conduct of intelligence, because if any person knows that if I'm a source of South Africa, 10 years down the line, my name will be public, you'll end up with very ineffective intelligence agencies. Whether that one was put into consideration without going into substantive discussion at this stage.
I might have another two or three ultra book at any time.
Are you asking for another round?
Yes. I'm asking for another.
Proceed on the bottom.
Yes. Dr. Quelle had just asked about cost implications. Now, Chair, if one reads through the presentation made by Carenza, naturally at various points here one can see that there will be enormous cost implications. And I would just like her to respond to it. For example, on this hard copy on page 10, it is stated here in the first slide at the top, the last sentence, shall report such possession and return such record to a member of the South African Police Service or the NIA. Now, Chair, you know, recently we hear that in Great Britain, important classified documents have been found on trains and things. Is that perhaps a possible consequence that such a classified document may just be loaded up with an ordinary officer at the police station, whether that is what would happen if this bill were to go through in its current form. Then, Chair, on page 12, the top slide, the last paragraph there. Organs of state are required to inform the Minister of Intelligence Services of the results of the regular reviews and also to publish such results for public scrutiny. The question here is, I don't know, Advocate Swart must help me with the correct word here. I have asked here, is that a toolbar? Is it, what say, Paul? Is it?
Practical.
Oh, yeah, well, it's not the right word, but in any case, I think Karenza would understand what we're trying to get here.
No, Mr. Adler, let's get clarity on what it is you're trying to say. If you're not sure what you're trying to say, I don't think...
You're not sure?
Let's first get to Mr. Adler's clarity. If you're not sure what you want to say, I think it's unfair to ask the presenters to know what you want to say now. You're talking about whether it's doable. You're talking about whether this, it's practical, whether this particular thing, provision can be implemented.
You see, Chair, a presentation is being made by the legal advisor of the minister. The object of her presentation, naturally, is to try and convince this committee that what is stated in this bill is something that Cabinet has approved, that it is a toolbar. They could carry the provisions of this bill out. Now, I'm merely asking so that when we need to apply our minds, that we are equipped with how the ministry thinks about these things. Because at the end of the day, Chair, let us just remember one thing in lawmaking, and that is that any measure that is put on the statute book has to be a practical measure. It must be able to service broad society, the state, and everyone involved. And I'm merely questioning that, you know, to make a simple statement that organs of state are required to inform the minister of the results of regular reviews, and also to publish such results for public scrutiny. Is this going to happen? Is it a toolbar? Exactly, from my experience, it does not happen. I would like to know, perhaps, you know, there may be some mechanism that is being proposed. What I'm trying to say, Chair, is that perhaps, and I haven't referred to the bill here now, perhaps there needs to be something else that needs to ensure that this can happen. And then, Chair, I want to relate this issue of something that must happen. I want to relate it to the next slide, on page 13, the top slide again. The minister, appeal procedure to the minister of the organ of state that refused the request is provided in clause 32. Okay, it must be lodged within 30 calendar days of the refusal by the head of the organ of state. In other words, it would mean that after 30 days, boom, finish. You've got no chance of lodging any appeal. The minister must make his or her decision on appeal within 90 days of receiving the appeal. Now, Chair, my problem here again is that the final arbiter is, in this case, the executive. And that if the arbitration provided by the executive in upholding the appeal or rejecting the appeal or whatever is not satisfactory to the person that had lodged the appeal, there is no mechanism yet that would provide that individual or that entity any form of recourse. So in other words, Chair, you are actually telling, you say eintlik vir die wolf, jy moet agter die skaap kyk en alles. That doesn't work, Chair. So I'm just highlighting so that Corenza could perhaps give us some responses. There may be some other mechanism, unless if a person wants to go to court. And that's a costly procedure. Does the ordinary citizen, do you place them in a position to be able to question decisions taken? And then, Chair, the lower one, the Cabinet apparently, according to Corenza's response here, in her presentation, if you take the issue of the disputes that are to be referred to the Minister of Intelligence, and that there's been criticism, that there's no independent oversight mechanism, but in her presentation, she said that the original draft contained the provision for an independent oversight mechanism, but that the Cabinet did not accept the suggestion of an independent oversight mechanism. That's how I understood it. Now, Chair, is there any reasonable explanation? Because, you see, Chair, the problem is that if you are going to, well, of course, it's something that we need to consider later, but since she is here, I would like to have the benefit of what the thinking was. The Cabinet finds that it is not necessary for any decision taken by the minister to be questioned by any oversight mechanism, even, for example, a mechanism similar to the JSCI, then, Chair, it takes this bill, to my mind, instead of protecting information, and all in the name of the protection of information, it takes us to the dark ages, where we are not willing to subject ourselves as executive to any form of scrutiny. And I think, Chair, that is a very dangerous element that comes into this bill. And we would just like to understand the sense thereof. And that is why I've asked the state law advisors also earlier, to which I trust she will respond, as to whether they measure up bills that come before them against the provisions of the Constitution. Because the Constitution, on the other hand, Chair, is quite clear. It talks of fairness and the rights of people and all sorts of things. But now I believe that this bill now sort of limits those rights. It subjugates those rights. It places too much power in a member of the executive. And the executive actually has an interest in seeing that this particular bill becomes law. And you are asking the same executive that they must give judgment on something which a member of the public or an entity is unhappy about. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, the Honourable Abram. I have Mr. Londis down, and then the Honourable Advocate Swat, and then
Chairperson, mine is also to either parental or state law advisor, whose name we don't have, by the way. Chair, mine relates to the Defence Force. In Howard Varney's presentation to the committee, it wasn't really made clear. Well, it was pointed out to us that the South African Police Services and the South African National Defence Force, in terms of Clause 37(2), were excluded from the guidelines being provided by NIA. But what is still not clear is whether both those bodies, the Police Service and the Defence Force, are part of this regime and system. If they're not, then what do we have in place there? Because we also have in Clause 36(5), the Department of Defense has its own archive repository, which is established in terms of the Defense Act, and we're told that that is part of the National Declassification Database. So we just need a bit of clarity with regard to the role played by both the Defence Force and the Police Service in the system that we're putting into place now. Whether they are bound by what we're going to put into law, or whether there is another system or regime in place for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Landers. The Honourable Advocate.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Mine is just to add on to Ms. Alden's last question. He'd make reference to the way I understand it that an earlier draft talked about independent body listening to appeals. On the slide, it talked about the creation of a multi-departmental panel. You also talk about oversight and scrutiny. A multi-departmental panel is nothing like that. So I just need clarity on. Of course, I also initially understood the previous briefing or previous discussion that it was indeed some reference to an independent appeal procedural panel, while this slide now makes provision of or talks about the departmental. And just know what it was. Because if Cabinet rejected the idea of a multi-departmental panel, there may be a specific reason for that, whilst if they reject an idea of an independent
appeal mechanism, there might very well be a completely different reason for that.
Thank you, the Honourable.
Thank you, sir. May I just say, this was a mouthfather,
and somebody who usually works in the open domain, whereas your specialization is in a more closed domain. I would just like to express appreciation for the way the ministry staff, and now today the state law advisors, have presented the background to this bill. I mean, it's not every day that you find that people give a little insight into what their thinking and their own argumentation was, what their own response to comments received on the Gazetted bill was, and I think that's very good, and I appreciate it. And I imagine it has something to do with the minister himself, because I don't think that Ronnie Casserold is someone who would like to leave a legacy of legislation which has the kind of deleterious effect which I think Mr. Abraham very, very vividly sketched, and which we will certainly help to avoid. So just a word of thanks from my side. But then I would like to, there are some things that bother me very greatly, and no doubt I will learn many things while sitting with all of you who are specialized, but there are many, many things that I find very hard to swallow. And one of them is, and I wondered if Ms. Carenza would now just enlighten me a little bit, the idea of making commercial information confidential. How do you justify this? I mean, the access to information regime already deals with circumstances under which you can decline to disclose commercial information. And so, you know, the business world can't work if everybody has to expose all the time what their business plans and their calculations are. But why are we making it possible for commercial information to be confidential, the disclosure of which may cause financial loss to an entity? Or, now imagine ESCOM. The disclosure of which may prejudice an entity in its relations with its clients. So now ESCOM can now hide from view under this law. Am I interpreting it right? It can hide from view the fact that it is sourcing its coal in small and quantities that are not sufficient to generate electricity. That it is sourcing wet coal from inappropriate suppliers. And that they can now say, but this is confidential. The public may not know. While we sit in a dark winter, plunged into darkness and freezing cold, and unable to watch our TVs or charge our cell phones, ESCOM will it not be able then simply to draw the veil and say, sorry, you know, this is an interstate entity and it's commercial information, and we don't want a bad relationship with our clients. And it also mustn't prejudice its relationship with competitors. I mean, if we are going to try to open up a sector like electricity, for example, I mean, how can you? I simply do not understand how. So I would be indebted to you for an answer on that. And just if I may say again, sir, what I said the other day to Advocate Varney, I think using Section 239 of the Constitution is extraordinarily wise, where all state departments essentially, unless exempted by Ronnie Wood, have to sit down and classify. And we see Mr. Abraham is right. The government departments can't even cope with the access to information stuff. They can't, which is a lighter load. And the poor Human Rights Commission, which is supposed to invigilate this lot, can't get to it all. And so it is to me a matter of very great concern that the scope of this law is far, far too great.
Thank you, Ms. Schmatz. Is that all? Can we let the presenters answer the question that was presented now? Over to you, Ms. Karenza.
Okay, thanks. Let me deal with the Quinn's point first, sources and methods. I think, yes, I think that obviously sources and methods is one of the areas that would be covered by the bill, but it's also expressly protected in the intelligent services legislation. But just to refer you to the protections in this bill, if you look at page 12, look at what clause 15, what is in the national interest, And this section has actually been criticized, and I think it's been misunderstood. Because what the bill does is it says that, first of all, it defines sensitive information. And it says sensitive information is information which must be protected from disclosure in order to prevent the national interest from being harmed. There's been some recommendations about changing the language there slightly, but it doesn't really alter the essence of what we're trying to say. And then we define the national interest. We say these are the kinds of things that may be part of the national interest. And if Member Quilly, you look at subsection 3 under that clause, it would include the kinds of issues that you've raised as a concern. Now, having said that, those are things which may conceivably be protected from disclosure. Although, if something is part of an is formed within what is considered to be in the national interest, doesn't automatically mean it must be prevented from disclosure. It still has to comply with the other provisions about how you would actually assess whether or not you classify information. But I think to answer your question, yes, it is contemplated. As far as protecting in the long term sources. This is something that we obviously have to consider in the context of saying how do we deal with apartheid legislation and information that is actually still classified, that has not even been reviewed. And that's why we have that clause that says all information before 10th of May 1994 is declassified unless it would comply with the provisions of this Act, which doesn't mean that you automatically make those kinds of things open. It just means that it has to comply with the provisions of this Act. Now, in relation to things like sources, and much of that information is in fact more than 20 years old, in deciding whether or not to retain that, to keep that information classified, you'd have to have regard to the provisions in this bill that deal with longer protection periods of 20 and 30 years. And you've seen there that if there could be demonstrable threat to life, physical harm, that would still retain its classification. So I think we were very mindful of that when we were looking at how to deal with that legislation. But we had to have some kind of legal mechanism of aligning what had happened before with what had happened, with what the new protection regime must be, given the fact that information is actually not being declassified. Right. As far as the cost implications, yes, there obviously are cost implications, but the reason that we said there are no cost implications in terms of this bill is because those costs were factored into another component. There would be two cost implications. One in relation to training, and the second in relation to personnel that would have to audit and declassify. Now, in relation to training, I think some of the members of this committee that are part of the JSCI would have received the briefings from NIA on the implementation of the National Vetting Strategy, which requires NIA to provide training to across government departments on information security. That is really covered through in this bill. It requires government departments as well to set up security committees. Those costs were factored into the implementation and the rollout of the national vetting strategy, and possibly what I needed to do is to make those figures available to the committee if you'd want. Just to, I think the point for you is just yes, those things have been considered, but it wasn't necessary for us to go to Cabinet and say we need additional money because that was already taken care of. As far as the personnel to audit and declassify, in the Cabinet memo, and there's an edited version that's attached to the book, what we said is that at this stage we were not able to assess whether or not there would be additional personnel that needed to be employed. In the original version of the book, in the drafting process, we initially suggested that within 5 years of implementation of this bill, all government departments would need to have audited and declassified that information that should be declassified. And in fact, it was the SANDF and the SAPS that asked us to change that to 10 years because of the concern about additional personnel implication. And they were saying at this stage they felt that they could cope with with existing personnel if we had changed, if we had the 10-year provision which we have now. Okay, as far as the return of classified documents, that's just a clause that we thought we should put in as a safety mechanism, that if in fact somebody happens to be in possession of documents that are classified, at least they know that there's an obligation to return them. I mean, there are many instances where newspapers, documents are leaked, and they say, well, we got this classified information. Now, we're simply saying that if you're actually in possession of a classified document and you reasonably ought to see that this is classified, you return it either to the NIA or you return it to the SAPS.
After
making
a copy.
No, we're trying, yeah. But, and the reason we said the SAPS is because obviously it's not always written who's the owner of this document. That's really just trying to, if in the event it does happen, well, we've got a mechanism to try to take action. But I think the law only establishes frameworks and guidelines that actually sometimes, As far as the appeal procedure and the independent oversight, in the appeal procedure, because even in the existing legislative framework, because government departments themselves are responsible for classifying their own information, obviously informed by this bill and informed by these guidelines, and that's why the Minister of Intelligence is responsible for putting in place national guidelines in terms of this bill. A member of the public would ask an individual government department to declassify information. We had proposed initially as the drafting team, as the ministry drafting team, that if in the case of an internal dispute, there needed to be an interdepartmental team where the Minister of Intelligence would act as arbiter. And that didn't find favor. That was separate from the independent oversight mechanism. And that, I think, just simply has to do with the fact that the departments feel that they have their own mechanisms in place and they're able to make these decisions themselves. That is something that I think we have referred to in the explanatory notes, and I think the committee is going to have to ultimately. I think members would be aware that the legislative drafting process, especially in with a piece of legislation like this, involves a whole lot of consultation and consideration internally. And sometimes at the end of the process, there are sometimes unintended consequences that you as a drafting team don't necessarily think about at that particular point, or there could be possible interpretations that you don't want. And that's why I think we have summarized the explanatory notes to say, and I think the Minister is on record as saying he doesn't want unintended consequences, and that's why he's asking the committee to consider what the submissions have been. As far as the independent oversight mechanism, and here if I could just also deal with the question that dealt with the SANDF, Member Landers, the SANDF and the SAPS, and answer your question as well, Member Swart. This bill applies to all organs of state, which means that every single government department or organ of state, and the organ of state has a definition in the
government.
Certainly. All organs of state would need to comply with this bill if they had information in their possession which warranted protection. And that's why in the application of the bill, there is the provision for the minister to exempt. Again, what our intention was is that as the drafting committee was to try to prevent, for example, the bus company. Yeah, from having to establish departmental processes and procedures to protect information when actually none of the information it deals with forms part of should be protected. And that's why we've got this exemption. But we needed some kind of systematic way to say, if we're saying it applies to all organs of state, we actually had to have then a mechanism to say, but that is ridiculous. because not, the bus company wouldn't need to classify, and that's why we've made provision for the exemption. Again, I think the committee is going to need to decide whether or not the provision that we've tried to put in place to prevent those kind of ludicrous consequences, whether that's sufficient. But now, if I can deal with the issue of the SAPS and the SANDF. So the guidelines and criteria established in this bill for classification, declassification, the criteria that would inform whether or not something is secret, top secret, confidential, apply to all organs of state unless exempt, would apply equally to the SAPS and to the SANDF. In the internal government consultation process, the SAPS and the SANDF said to us that they have sufficient capacity and counterintelligence capacity internally to first of all provide their own training and to manage the oversight, because the responsibility of the NIA in relation to other government departments is to provide training and to exercise oversight, and they simply said to us that they felt they could do it themselves, to have the necessary capacity. That doesn't mean that they would be able to apply different criteria. And you see, where there is an exception made for the SANDF is in the classification. And I think I've explained this to the committee before, that the SA, we abolished the restricted category of classification. But the SANDF asked us to retain it only in relation to them, because they said that there's a certain category of orders, instructions that are given that are operational, that don't require a confidential classification rating. And if we were not to provide them with the option to do that, that actually it would lead to unintended expenditure, because they have a whole range of people in the department that don't ever get classified up to a confidential status. So even the exceptions in relation to them are actually noted in this bill. As far as the independent body, what we had suggested was what we called an independent oversight body, and we had made NIA responsible for making sure that other government departments, with the exception of SANDF and SAPS, complied with government policy, and then we made provision for their minister to establish what is an independent body to first of all be the arbiter of any kind of disputes and to check compliance and oversight. Again, I think I have expanded on the reasons. Cabinet felt that what we were doing is that we were creating another administrative body, and they were concerned about. That's what they were concerned about. And again, as I said in the explanatory notes, I think that the committee is going to have to decide whether or not there is a requirement for an independent oversight body. Certainly, the lack of an independent oversight body has been criticised, and we've noted the criticisms. Of course, the jurisdiction of the court is not removed. So yes, technically, if there is anybody can take a decision on review, as the independent newspapers took the Minister of Intelligence on review to the Constitutional Court. Again, I think the committee has to decide on what is the appropriate mechanism. Alright. The comments about too much power being in the hands of the executive, I think it relates to the issue of oversight. Again, I've clarified that. To respond to Member Smuts's point, commercial information, are we classifying commercial information? I think if you look at, I'll tell you what our intention was, and then you can assess whether or not you think we're going too far. If you look at page 12 of the published book, clause 16. Okay, see how we're not dealing with all commercial information. This bill applies to state information. State information is information that is in the hands of the state. So it deals with commercial information in the hands of the state. Well, it deals with, it applies to only commercial information in the hands of the state.
And the definition of what commercial information is in this clause is just descriptive. It simply says this is commercial information. It says you can only protect, it says basically this is what commercial information is. This bill applies to commercial information in the hands of the state, but in order to protect it, it would have to comply with the principles articulated in the bill for classifying information. So the disclosure would have to lead, do you know the way we've categorized confidential, secret, top secret? That was our thinking. That's simply to protect. So if the state, for example, contracts a private company to perform certain sensitive research for it, that information would be classified. That was the intention behind it. I think the explanatory notes do point out that some of the people that have criticized the bill have said that possibly we need to review the framing of the language because it might have an unintended consequence. And I think. Regular reviews and making reports. What this means is that government departments that have in their possession classified information every 10 years need to review that information and decide does it still need to be classified, and if not, can it be made public? Yeah, and I mean the mechanism there would be to send it to the declassification database, which will be managed by National Archives. Archives already managed it. And possibly to publish some of that on their website. So we're not thinking of we're simply saying that actually every 10 years you need to go through this process of auditing your information and making it available. And we've actually tried to be not to be bureaucratic. So we've also said that government departments would have their own processes and procedures for making that information available, and not necessarily through the formal bureaucratic process of PIA. But actually, if you decide information is declassified, then as a government department, you should be able to put it on the website. That's what happens in other countries, or you send it to the archive. And then members of the public can actually just go and access it without actually having to make a formal request, PIA, paying your 30 rand, making a copy. And that's why I think we would be very eager to have this legislation listed in the schedule of PIA, because our experience of PIA as well is that some government departments are adopting the processes and procedures in PIA
strictly.
Yes, and I mean PIA itself doesn't contemplate that. PIA, the processes are actually the default. That because I shouldn't have to request my driver's license through PIA. I think that's what we're trying to do. So I think yes, it is feasible, but at the same time, it must be feasible because you can't have a situation where there isn't a review of information, because it actually costs money to protect information.
You make quite a startling statement there, Lorenzo. Yeah. It costs money to protect information.
But
when we are being told that there's no financial implications here. But I think let us hear what the state law advisor has to say.
Thank you, sir. The question that was directed to me, that I will respond to, is the question that is on evolution. The others are policies that have been covered by my learned friend Karen. To answer to the question, Chair, through you, Chair, answering, is that on our certification process, yes, we do, but it's not, we don't call it evaluation, we call it scrutiny. So we scrutinize the legislation for purposes of trying to make it simple, that is using simple language that it can be understood by every member of the public without going through the assistance of a lawyer to understand the legislation. That is our intention. Another one is to sort of we sort of look at the existing laws that have been passed by Parliament. If this new legislation is not going to conflict with the existing law, we also scrutinize the constitutionality of that piece of legislation. Is it not violating the Constitution? If it has to violate provisions of the Constitution, is it justifiable? So those are the also things that we look at. We also do a comparative study. That is, we look at the foreign legislation and the international law. That's what we do in our scrutiny. So that's why we always insist on the departments to give us adequate time to go through that. So they mustn't submit a legislation just a week. So it is practically impossible for us to do that. So my colleague will recall that we often figure that the time that we must be given, it must be enough for us to go through that certification process. So I think I've covered your comments. So,
and you are satisfied, Chair? You are satisfied that this bill, as it's now presented, is within the bounds of the constitutional requirements?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, but one cannot say a legislation it cannot be challenged. That will be a false. Every lawyer knows that. So they always find something to say with something that is their nature.
Thank you, Ms. Doodle.
The Honourable Fuller. Just a clarification on the bill, Clause 26. The automatic declassification. it was one of the aspects we're asking what the international comparison is, because I'm just worried about the implications of that to take into account of our negotiated performance. they automatically disclassified until they're disclassified in terms of this act. How the practicality of reclassifying all what is classified under apartheid legislation or apartheid era. And whether there's been any comparison. I know the Germans did the West German information, whether you have looked into it, whether East German, sorry, or the West German declassified the information which was held under the West German, East German. They are the same. I think one is West, and I'm not sure which one. I'm just worried about the young democracy we have, whether the implications of, I'm just looking at the reclassification in terms of this act of all those volumes. Do we have an idea how much is this information which will need to be reclassified? Is it large? Is it medium? Is it doable? Maybe let me because one has got just uninformed sense that there are volumes of information which are there. If then at the application of this law we just say this is automatically declassified, whether will we have personnel to handle that information if it is large? So that's my own experience. And what has been the experiences in other countries which went through transitions like us? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable. The Honorable Secretary.
Thank you, Chair. My name is page 15, chapter 11, offenses and penalties. You know, when you are sitting on a paper and you're still working, doing paperwork, and you begin to think on the implementation of the paperwork, then it becomes even much more naughty. Can you unpack for me bullet 1, 2, 3, 4, where you're saying the heading is offensive and penalties, where you're saying registration of intelligence agents and related offenses? What are those related, and what is it? Why should registration of intelligence agents be an offense and need to be penalized? The last question on that chapter is about, I'm looking at the type of offenses and penalties, and practically, I'm trying to find out about things that are not mentioned here, like vetting, the aspect of vetting and failing to do it, and employing a person who failed vetting. And I'm looking and just trying to find out under which bullet will that institution be charged. I'm not saying that last question, you can answer it yourself. But really, when you look at the paper and you look at what is happening on the ground, and you now say, with the passing of this act, and it still does not include the employment of people who failed vetting and those who are not vetted. But bullet 4, you can answer it. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable. Before we go, just Honorable Landers, and then after that, the Honorable Swat. The tea is available. I think we'll take the two questions to finish off this round, and then once the questions have been taken, we can go for tea and come back and take the answers, if that's fine with the committee. To the Honourable Lawrence.
Oh, thank you. Chairperson, mine, Dr. Corley just reminded us, and if Corenza could just assist us, we accept that Al-Athani was commissioned by the ministry, but he did undertake to provide us with all the examples of similar regimes internationally. Now, we're aware of some of them, Britain, USA, New Zealand, Australia, Germany, so on, but we just like some document that sets them out and gives us an indication of what we can measure this legislation against. Dean Smart is correct when she refers to the Algoa Bus Company. But I want to put to you the opposite extreme, where the minister is putting here as the person who resolves disputes, and just make the point that at the end of the day we must decide. So he could decide, for example, to excuse Seth. It's a ridiculous excuse.
problem, but I'm making it anyway. But at the end of the day, we need to decide who's going to take that decision. Someone has to do it. And if we're not happy that it's the minister, then we should start applying our minds as to who that person should be. And to make, well, that's one possible solution, and I'm not convinced of it at the moment. We just need to also bear in mind, Chairperson, that we should never legislate for an individual. Today it's Ronnie Casserole, so we have a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling about Ronnie Casserole, because he is the person that he is. But his successor may be the equivalent of Idi Amin or Darth Vader. And so one always bears that in mind. When I look at legislation, I'm not interested in that. The fact that the minister is running councils. What's your problem? No. My problem is if the minister is Darth Vader or Idi Amin, and you're saying to him, we're giving you the authority to exclude certain state entities, and then you realize the implications that brings with it. But at the end of the day, Shepard, we'll have to decide. Corinza's not going to help us with that. Neither is Ronnie Casserole's going to help us with it. We'll have to apply our minds and decide.
Thank you, the Honourable Lounders. Shall we take the Honourable Advocate Swatter, the last question poser for the session, and we'll have tea after this.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. My question would go to the learned colleague of the State Law Advisor, Ms. Kohenza. I presume Vader is not family of Vardy. Who's this Vader? Who's this Vader guy?
I am your father.
Chair, on a serious note, I just want some clarity. The minister may, adding on to the Honourable Anders, the minister may exempt. Don't you, just some idea, don't you think we should make provision for a lot more clarity on that? May the minister exempt on the application of a state of organ? May he unilaterally decide to exempt? May he exclude? You understand that? And that's very much in line with my colleagues' concerns here. What are the criteria for such decisions? And I probably think we need to look at that. Does it mean exclude unilaterally from his site or exempt on application? What was the thinking process? Then the other question, Chief, to be quick about this, and I fully understand Dr. Kelly's problems with the time and the declassification, I think. In particular with reference to the National Defence Force, Afghan Defence Force, that sort of thing, and even the police to some extent, I presume. But in particular, the Defence Force. Every 10 years, they need to look at every document, every thing that's classified there. I presume there's not much that's not classified there. We know there's warehouses and warehouses full of documents. They need to go through a process rather quickly after this becomes law in terms of the pre-1994 classified documents. What input did the Defence Force give to the Ministry or to the drafters as to the time constraints of these specific clauses?
Thank you, Honourable Swatzer. Mr. Enzer and the State Law Advisor's Office. We shall go to Tina. You can work on the answers to the questions. You're also invited to tea. And we'll deal with your answers when we come back. Members, please, let's look at five minutes, please, ma'am.
I'm not going to do that.
I'm most confused because I've got sinus as well. Sometimes I have a sinus attack and it feels like there's things like two symptoms.
If it's flu, you can get a very
good
this year. Everybody I've spoken to, the flu I have. I'm Frankie Jenkins, legal advisor to Parliament. I'm supposed to help the community with their legislative function.
Let's settle down, members. Before you answer, Ms. Carenza, just by way of the way forward now, we'll take your answers and then go on to the presentations on the other two bills we spoke about. There was just one thing that concerned me, if I might be allowed to ask a question to. The minister, in terms of the bill, appears to be going to exercise authority over a whole lot of organs of state. Also making regulations affecting these different organs of state. Can you just help us with the thinking behind it? Was consideration given to that the conflict that might arise given the minister exercising his authority?
Can I start? All right. let me deal first with Member Quillen's point about what is the experience in other countries. And I think the concern, the specific concern is in relation to apartheid legislation, that particular automatic declassification clause, and how other countries have dealt with making information available in a context of transition. I think your specific concern is, would any of the provisions of this bill undermine any of the agreements and the spirit and the undertakings given in relation to our negotiated transition? I think from our perspective, and this is also something that when we presented the bill to cabinet, we were asked on, is this provision on automatic declassification going to undermine any of those undertakings? And I think legally we felt no, because I don't think that this provision is going to lead to a situation where any of the undertakings that we made in relation to the information that we need to protect is going to be automatically disclosed. members may be aware, certainly the members of the JSCI would be aware, that this bill is really consolidating the recommendations of two previous ministerial commissions, one on classification, declassification, and one on the regulation of the private security industry with the focus on private intelligence. The classification, declassification commission, in looking at how other countries deal with this kind of transition, they went on quite a wide-ranging study tour, and I think that if members have seen their report, I think a copy was sent to the JSCI. But what comes out very clearly is that there's actually no standard. That countries have decided to do this differently. Some of the Eastern European countries simply decided to make all of the information that was previously classified open at the time of their transitions. The East Germans, after the unification of Germany, the Germans decided initially to make all of the East German information available, but then they changed that, and now you have to apply and you have to establish a basis and interest. And I think that there is no standard, and I think that it depends. What we needed to be mindful of when we were drafting this bill is that because of the undertakings given during the negotiations, we could not adopt the position that said everything that was previously closed needs to be open, because that's not the basis on which our transition was negotiated. But we also needed some way of trying to reconcile legally what happened before with the current legislative framework. So we really had there were two things that we could have said as the drafters. We could have said, well, everything that was previously classified is now declassified and open, or alternatively we could have said, well, everything that was previously classified will remain classified. Now both of those legally just would have been untenable. So what we tried to say is, what are the principles that would inform classification going forward? How do we give the guarantees that we're required to give, but at the same time make that information that was previously classified, that actually doesn't need to be retained as classification status, open? And I think that's the basis on which we've tried to draft this clause. As far as the practical considerations, I think both members Guerlain and members Swart, you asked that. In the ministry drafting team, we also had a reference group, that was an interdepartmental reference group that we met with quite a lot, and that was Justice, SAPS, and SAMDS, because many of these the consequences of this bill have got implications for them. The person from our team, from the SANDF, was a person who deals with information management, so who deals with classification, also deals with declassification, because there have been some initiatives to try to declassify information, existing information in government, but it's haphazard, and it's not really coordinated by any kind of coherent policy frameworks, because the existing MIS does make provision for some kind of declassification. It does say that classification is time bound. So they certainly gave us the assurance that they would be able to to do this. And to the extent that we changed some provisions of the bill, like for example the 10-year versus the 5-year period, was really as a result of the SAND saying to us, but you know, ultimately we have to be able to do this. And they were also pointing to another thing, and that is the moratorium on the destruction of documents. That is why our declassification actually makes provision for you to declassify a series of information. So you, so government departments could say that all information between this period relating to this particular thing, this particular subject matter, could automatically be declassified. So we have tried to also prevent a situation where it would mean practically that you have to go through each and every document. Of course, there are going to be circumstances where you have to go through each and every document because it would have things like names, sources, certain things. But also, I mean, there is different kind of information. So there may be certain things that could simply just be declassified in bulk. We've made provision for that as well. So yes, I think it is going to be something that we as the drafters were also really guided by the practical advice from the SAPS and the SANDS and from NIA and SAS. On how they would actually, the implications of this would practically. As far as the exemption clause and the powers of the minister on good cause, the application of the bill, I think for us the exemption clause is actually exempting certain organs of state from the requirement of classifying, from the requirement of putting in place government internal processes and procedures. It's not because. And really, that's what it's supposed to do. So it's actually, it's not. And the fact that the bill applies to all organs of state doesn't imply that all organs of state actually have to classify. I mean, if you don't have information in your possession, that doesn't fit the criteria of the classification. You can't classify it. You can't restrict access. So I think I think my colleague from the State Law Advisor would add here that possibly this clause is being interpreted out of context from what its intention is. What some other countries do is that the minister, the person responsible for administering the bill, actually annually or every 5 years publishes a schedule, says these departments are exempted from the application of this bill, in the same way as except I think what we did is we said that application has to be made to the minister on good cause. So the minister has to consider that. So that's why the exemption is from the requirement to classify. So for example, SAS is not going to apply to the minister to be exempt from the requirement to classify. I think September. Exempting from the requirement to classify. So I'm the bus company, and I write to the minister and I say, please, I don't want to have internal departmental processes and procedures. Even if they did want to, they wouldn't be able to in terms of this act, because the fact that you decide, you need to comply with the act. I mean, the information in your possession has to be worthy of classification. I can't decide as a bus company that all of a sudden my information about travel routes is to be classified as top secret. And again, classification has to be for a proper purpose. So if the reason for wanting to classify that meant to try to prevent access to information for an improper process, that's unlawful in terms of this act. And the other thing that as well that I think we've done, and again you'll have to decide whether or not we've gone far enough, is that it's an offence to improperly classify, which means that officials actually have to, because we don't want the default position to be classification. There actually has to be some kind of thought process. What is the content of this information, and what is the consequences of the disclosure? So Yes, I think there is an obligation to make sure that people are properly trained, and that is the responsibility of NEA, which just leads me to the other issue. NEA, in terms of the National Strategic Intelligence Act, has the counterintelligence mandate, which is translated into an information security mandate, which is why NEA in this bill, with the exception of SAPS and the SCNS, who, as I explained, has said they've got their own capacity, are responsible for training across government departments, and they currently do that. And that is why I think that the responsibility of NEA was simply carried over in this act, and that's also why the Minister of Intelligence has certain responsibilities. I mean, somebody had to administer this bill, this act, when it's the current Protection of Information Act is administered by the Minister of Justice. But in the drafting team and in our consultations with Justice, we felt it was more appropriate for the Minister of Intelligence to administer this bill because NEA has the information security mandate. So the responsibility of the Minister is to put in place national standards and national regulations for how information would be protected. But as you see, we also make provision for government departments to have their own processes and procedures. So where it might be necessary for one department to have quite elaborate processes and procedures, it may not be necessary for another department to do that. The members of the JSCI will be aware that one of the things that has been in the pipeline for a long time, and really as a response to the lack of implementation of NIST, is a need for national information security standards. What the regulations contemplated by the Minister in terms of this act are actually those, but modified in terms of this act. As far as the offences and penalties, why we've said registration of intelligence agencies and related offences, I'm not sure why we've got that as a heading. If you look at the offences under that particular clause 43, what we require here is that anybody who's employed or operating as an intelligence security agent of a foreign service even has to register. The related requirement is that if they're not employed but they're here for the purposes of being reactivated, that they have to register. I think that's really just to provide us, if in the course of some kind of investigation you actually pick up somebody that's a sleeper agent or working for a foreign intelligence service and they're not registered, that's your offence if you can't charge them under espionage. So that was just something that we thought about. And it is in fact a requirement of other regimes that they require intelligence agents to register. As far as the making an offence not to employ people or not vetted, no, we didn't contemplate that in this bill. I think I think that is dealt with in two other bits of legislation, the National Strategic Intelligence Act, which requires anybody who's got access to classified information to be vetted. Also, if you're required to have access to classified information and your vetting is withdrawn, your security clearance is withdrawn, then that would be an operational reason for dismissal. But we were dealing with the protection of state information and the way you classify, declassify, and offences relating to unauthorized access to information. We didn't deal with that specific issue.
My thought patterns. Honourable members, those are the responses to the questions. The Honourable Swartz appeared to have wanted to pose another question. Looks quite serious. And then. The Honourable Landis, there will be after Swat, and then the Honourable Nila Patel. Abram? Yeah, Abram, do you have a question to put?
Are you looking for?
I don't want to list you if you don't have anything to put.
No, no, I'll probably
have. The Honourable Abram and the other members, please, we still have another two bills to deal with, so please, if you have a line of questions, make it short. It's not short, I'm going to ask the state law Carenza to be very short with your answers.
Sure, well, you anticipated me a bit. I wanted to ask how long it's going to take for the other two bills. Because we are now really getting, we are asking for clarity, but we're actually nudging into substance. What I want to ask is touching onto substance. In the sense that I want to ask, we had an answer on the categories of information in terms of declassification. There's a lot of concern about the categories of information for classification. If an argument is put forward that only the security departments may be able to categorize, classify in categories, what would be remarks on that? Generally, I can see I'm moving into the substance now. So you may either remove out of order or most of us must be ruled out of order.
I think if it pleases you, Honourable Swart, that you park that question for a later time. Would it please you? The Honourable Honour. The first one is a very easy, well, let me pose the question. Section 4, clause 47. I'm highly amused by this. I understand the background to the clause. Clause 47. Provision of false information to intelligence structures. Is this doable? Are we serious? Is Manzini and DG Mia going to go to court and say, he lied to me? And then this guy will say, yes, well, I'm an intelligence operative. That's my job, to lie to you. And Manzini will say, yes, but it's an offense, yes. That's why I'm asking, is this really doable? I understand the background and the history to it, but I think Corinda, I hope she grasps the point I'm trying to make here. And we're not going to make a laughing stock of ourselves. And then, Chairperson, from our own experiences on the JSCI, we've seen this happen. There's provisions in, say, Clause 52, where the courts are obliged to protect certain information. Now, do the offences and penalties clause applicable to the courts? If they fail, somebody's saying, yeah. How are you gonna prosecute?
You must correct him.
No, that's my question.
Why is it logistical?
Why is that about
and practical? If the court fails, it says, yeah, they must do it. But it says if the court fails to do it, then what? Remember, there are clerks of the court. There's a lot of people there. And the presiding officer just says, I now declare that information is such and such. And I'm told they're supposed to follow certain procedures and so on. But we've had instances where that information has gotten into the wrong hand. In that situation, what happens? That's just my concern, Chairperson.
The Honourable Abra.
Chair, I'll park my question in my garage, Chair.
No, I've got one, Chair.
I'll park it for the present.
The Honourable Capitelli, is it parked? Okay. will hear, I'll hear you on the follow-up. Do you want to take a follow-up? Over to you.
Can I just ask that member Swart just repeat his question to me?
What the Honourable Swart said is that if you don't want to answer the question, you don't have to. We're hoping you will use your discretion.
You're hoping I won't answer?
No, I'm hoping you use your discretion.
But I didn't hear the question properly.
So you don't have to answer.
It's been, I think, with all due respect, let's talk. Okay, there is nevertheless a very serious concern of the Honourable Landers. The peddlers are being unfairly penalised here. It amounts to, is this really an offence? Can we just hear? Yeah. I can see the answer, but can we hear it?
Look, I think it is an offence, and I think it is implementable. Obviously, the decision to charge or not in the event that it occurs is there's always a discretion. I think that in the case of all offences, when you draft a law, you simply try to put in place a framework that says, in the event of this happening, you provide the state with an opportunity to take action, whether or not in every single instance. There will be action taken. I think that's a matter of discretion. I think what this is a response to is our recent history, going back 10 years from say the Mayoring Commission to where there has been an attempt by certain individuals to knowingly falsely supply information to the intelligence services with an intention of causing division. And so this is a response. This is a response to that. Of course. The issue here has to be that you have to knowingly supply that information. And as I say, the thing about legislation is you simply provide the state with an opportunity to respond. I think it is an offence that certainly the state law advisors didn't think it was not an offence. But you'd have to prove it.
Are we finished there?
The courts. Our experience of is that there's really a gap in the legislation, and this is not something that we actually contemplated at the beginning of this process. The draft has put this chapter in quite late, and it was after, it was really in response to the vacuum in the law, and they exist, you know, the current independent newspapers and intelligence service in the minister, that case. Well, what happened there is that there were certain records of the Masekela review that were confidential and were never made part of the public record, but were part of the court record. And the debate was there is was how do you actually protect those documents when they're part of the court record? And I think that what we are simply saying, we're not removing the discretion of the court, because you can never remove the discretion of the court. We're simply imposing a procedure. Now, in our experience, even in dealing with this particular case, it wasn't the court that was making those documents available. It was the parties to the proceedings. And we're simply saying that in a matter like this, before the court makes a decision to hold a case in camera or to make documents available, the starting point is that those documents will be protected, and that there'd have to be arguments, and that but this really happens in any way. I mean, in the current criminal matters where you're dealing with matters of national security, and the current Criminal Procedure Act makes provision for the court to actually entertain those kinds of discussions. I think the ultimate thing here
is that we could not remove the discretion of the court. So if after argument the court is going to decide that those documents should not remain protected, then the court will issue an appropriate order. But also our experience of the way the courts deal with this is, and also international experience, is that the courts actually defer. And as long as there is a rational basis for why you want to protect those documents, the courts are not necessarily going to overturn that decision, as was our experience in the Constitutional Court case. I mean, what was very interesting about this case is that the courts went through each and every document. They looked at each and every of the detailed reasons for the minister, that the minister advanced as to why the documents should be protected. And they retained the protection, except for one document which was never classified and was never actually introduced by the minister. I mean, that's a separate thing. I won't go into that detail. But I think the principle is that the courts are not necessarily going to overturn a decision that is rational and that is legitimate and that is motivated in terms of the bill.
Thank you. I think we've come to the end of this presentation on this bill. Two very important issues have come out here. Is the issue that the Honourable Dr. Pkwele has raised, and that is the information and the that went around the custody, the negotiated settlement. How is that going to be dealt with under this new bill? It obviously would be a major concern to a number of people. The other issue I think that is raised, which has been of concern to the JSCI, would be how to deal with information peddlers, and I think in this regard the Honourable Rounders has raised an important issue regarding Clause 47 as it presently stands. My personal opinion is I think we should add into that clause to mislead, to obtain reward or to prejudice. Because just giving false information, I can hardly see how that can amount to, and knowingly, the negligence issue and the intention issue, I think we will have problems sustaining such a thing in court. I think at some stage we need to consider, that you knowingly give this information with a purpose or the intention to mislead or to obtain a reward or to prejudice the state. Something to that effect should be added, and I can see no reason why that won't be a better clause in circumstances. But two very valuable points I think that we have covered and issues that have been concerning the JSCI. Without interfering now with the presenters, can we go over to the other two bills? I'm reliably informed that these bills are not major bills, and I'm informed that the presenters can in fact take us through the two bills in record time.
Are the bills available
yet? Yes. Mr. Abraham, if you had gone to your pigeonhole, you would have found.
No password.
No, there's no password.
Okay. But I can't see anything.
Excuse me, Scarenza, can you just give us some indication how long the two presentations will take?
This won't take long at all. I can do this in 15 minutes.
Both bills?
Yeah.
Both bills. Now, honourable members, please, can we have the presentation and then clarification and criticism and all that after the presentation, so that we at least get the presentation.
Thank you, members. I'm going to, there are two intelligence services amendment bills. The one is the National Strategic Intelligence Amendment Bill, and the other is the Intelligence Services Amendment Bill. In the main, what these bills deal with is internal changes to the arrangements of the intelligence services. In the main, they are technical, and I'll go through what the amendments are. The only issue that I think we foresee raising debate, possibly, although the bills have been published and we've not received any, there's been no reporting on them, is that the National Strategic Intelligence Amendment Bill makes provision to establish and regulate the National Communications Center, the NCC, as the signals intelligence capacity. These bills have been certified. I've also circulated other documents which I'm not going to present. The one is a document that says satellite signals intelligence comparison. Basically, what this is a summary of all the foreign comparative legislation that we could identify that deals with how interception of communications is regulated and how their signals intelligence capacities are established. And when I come to the provisions of the bill, I'll go into that in a bit more detail. And then there's also another presentation which was sent to you in color, but it basically just explains what signals intelligence is. Yeah, that's the one. Okay. Because I think for us it's very important that the starting point of dealing with the clauses that relate to the NCC is that conceptually you have to have a distinction between what a signals intelligence structure is and distinguish that from interceptions in terms of RICA. But I'll go through those provisions of the bill and explain why, in our view, they don't contravene RICA, and secondly, what assurances we've written into the bill to give you those guarantees. Okay. So what the National Strategic Intelligence Amendment Bill does is it establishes the National Communications Center, sorry, that should read NCC. It provides for SAS to assist NIA perform security screening functions, and it provides for the DG of NIA to delegate the responsibility for issuing, downgrading, withdrawing, or refusing security clearances. They're technical amendments in the sense that at the moment, the way the legislation is drafted, it's only the DG that can issue the clearance, can physically sign off on it. So we allow him to delegate that. So at the moment, the NIA is responsible for security screening of all public servants. The bill amends Section 2 of the Principal Act to allow for SAS to provide security screening services, and amends Section 2A6 to allow for the DG to delegate the issue of security screening to a delegated official. I don't think that's particularly controversial. They really were just technical. It also amends Section 5A of the Principal Act to provide for the establishment of field vetting units by organs of state that do not form part of the national intelligence structure, and to assist them in conducting security screening investigations. And these amendments are really to enforce the national vetting strategy. it's the national vetting strategy that I was making reference to earlier when I spoke about the cost implications. I think members of the JSCR have received briefings on NIA's national vetting strategy. It also broadens the membership of NICOC to include the Director General of the National Communications Center, the DG in the Presidency, and the DG of the Department of Foreign Affairs. And the only reason that we had to do that is because in law, the members of NICOC, the committee, are actually set up, but practically, these are the people that have also been attending NICOC meetings, so we needed to rectify that in law. It also provides that alternatives be at the level of the deputy head of the organization. whereas at the moment that doesn't, you have to be the head of the organization. And as you know, all the intelligence legislation, we have to go into more detail as a constitutional requirement. That is what the National Strategic Intelligence Amendment Bill deals with. I'm going to deal with the Intelligence Services Amendment Bill, and then I'm going to come back to the provisions that deal with the MCC, if that's okay, Chairperson, because I think that would require more discussion. The Intelligence Services Amendment Bill introduces new definition of the MCC. It removes the legislative requirement for the training fund to be established for the academy. As you know, at the moment, there is a requirement that a training fund be established. This removes that requirement. It changes the retirement age of members of the services to 55 in line with the broader public service. The way the legislation was drafted previously created some kind of confusion whether or not members who reach the age of 55 were entitled to retire. They could, but whether or not they were entitled to the benefits. So we simply aligned this to the Public Service Act. And there are also consequential amendments as a result of the amendments to the National Strategic Intelligence Act. These really are examples of this include extending the definitions in the Labor Relations Act to the NCC. I think in the schedule of the bill, you'll see that there's a list of what those consequential amendments are. And it's really what the state law advisors were doing to align it to all other legislation that applies to the intelligence services now would apply to the NCC. It also allows the minister to delegate the authority for acquiring, maintaining, and disposing of immovable property. At the moment, the minister has to sign off on all of those things. It's just impractical that every time you want to paint an office, the minister has to sign. So, as you can see, all of these amendments are really technical, and they as a response to things that possibly unintended consequences of the previous legislation. So the one policy area is the establishment of the NCC as the National Signals Intelligence Capacity. Now, just to provide members with some background, I think everybody's familiar with what signals intelligence is. It's the monitoring of all forms of global communication. It involves the monitoring and analysis of signals, both satellite and cable. Historically, the targets have been military and diplomatic communications. What happens is that there is a bulk collection of all of the information on the signals. When the signal is acquired, at that point, one does not know technically what that signal, what is on that signal, how many communications it includes voice communications, data, imagery, and then obviously there are a whole range of technical mechanisms to make sense to process that information. And I think the handout that was given that actually shows how the bulk information is processed and how you actually have to make sense of it. That would be, if you want me to go through that in more detail, if somebody can. As members are aware, the interception in South Africa is governed by the RICAD legislation, which provides for which says that any communication between the borders of the country, if any of the law enforcement agencies want to intercept that, they need to apply to a judge, get a warrant. It sets out certain criteria of that they need to make out. They need to be able to identify the individuals. They need to be able to say what it is that person is suspected of. It really was replacing the old Act 127 for those people who are familiar with it, although it was revised to take account of the changes in technology. In the document that I've given you on comparatives, you'll see that all countries deal with domestic interceptions in this way. They require you to identify the individual. That in the main, the reason why the authorization is sought is either for evidence purposes or to confirm or refute something specific. You'll see that the authorization requirements are different in those cases where mostly it's you require judicial authorization, except in the UK where the minister authorizes those kind of offences. In the clauses of the bill that deal with the establishment of the NCC, you'll see that the NCC will be authorized to collect and analyze foreign signals intelligence. And you'll see that there is a definition of foreign signals intelligence in the bill, which says that a foreign signals intelligence is electromagnetic. And there's a whole lot of technical terms, but basically what it means is that the signals intelligence capacity will be able to analyze and collect foreign signals that are transmitted externally outside of the borders of the country, and that means that are not transmitted on the domestic communication networks, but will not be authorized to collect those signals if the communication begins in the country. Well, if you look at the definition of signals, it says a foreign signal includes what passes through or ends in the Republic. Yeah, so which excludes, and that I think is really trying to say that those domestic communications, whether they are whether they begin in the country, the signals intelligence structure will not be able to collect them. That is the domain of RICA. If they want to monitor an international call that begins in the country, but is made outside of the country, they would have to get a judicial warrant for that. Okay. We also provide for the Minister of Intelligence to regulate the activities of the NCC, but there is a specific provision in the bill where the NCC will be subject to the oversight of the Inspector General. I must say that initial draft didn't include that. Initial draft presented to the committee didn't include that as a specific, because we assumed as the drafters that the NCC, once it's established as the national intelligence structure, would automatically be subject to the oversight of the Inspector General. But you'll see in the bill that has been certified, there is a specific requirement that the Inspector General must certify annually to Parliament that the NCC has not contravened the provisions of RICA. Okay. Right, that's
Thank you, Ms. Kavanaugh. I see the Honourable Two rounds, just two people. Okay, proceed.
Thanks, Chair. Well, I went through these two technical things, as you said, but there's just one or two questions. The foreign signals intelligence definition. Now, are we arguing that in the future we will never be able to enter a number of South African citizens as a primary target into the NCC in terms of calls emanating from this country? But there's no reference if that same South African citizen is outside of the country and phoning into the country. So here there's two questions now. But you argue that a foreigner or an international call, in other words, a non-South African citizen phoning from inside South Africa outside, now to comply with RICA in terms of a warrant. And that will place a burden on the NCC to go through the process of applying for warrants, whilst we are arguing that South African numbers will not be inputted there. In other words, that
they actually won't go through the warrant process in terms of that, but it will become the domain of OIC. I just think it's much on that. But in particular, the question about a South African citizen outside of the country fighting into the country. Say, for instance, I'm staying in Rome for a month or two studying or something, I should fight into the country. I'm using myself as an example, this is of course. I should fight into the country, and the NCC would want to monitor that as it gets in. Are you implying that I do not need, that I do not deserve or can count on the protection of the car when I'm outside of the country in terms of actions by people inside South Africa? And, both questions. Chairman, on something completely different, in terms of that section 3D of the Customs Services Amendment Bill, where the minister can delegate the head of the relevant delegation of the security clearance was in no thought about at least to indicate to what level of seniority it can be delegated, or is the idea that the DG of NIR can delegate this to a assistant deputy field agent or trainees? But I mean, are there no thought given to the level of the seniority of the level of such clearances? It is still at the end of the day, not just a administrative function.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Shane. Well, just a few questions. You talk of establishing Schedule 1 department. What's the Schedule 1 department? And that's a fresh thing. And then you say there are no financial implications, and that you're establishing a department. And my understanding is if we establish a department, we say DG, it's not DG at the moment, sorry? Yes. And the current there's no DG. And when we establish a department, it comes with all the sort of things that goes with the department, for whether they else have been looked at. And in the bill, you talk of promoting the coordination of optimal usage of all national signals intelligence. My understanding is that all the clusters were consulted. What was the view of the defense intelligence and the crime intelligence? How about defense intelligence? Because there was an exercise before where they refused. Where they refused that coordination or optimal integration of the capacity, signal the capacity. So have they changed from that now? Because my main worry is just the establishment of a department, because it comes with cost. What is the motivation for establishment of a department? Thank you.
Honourable members, we're going to run out of time. I saw these were the only two questions, so can we go over to Ms. Corenza for the answer?
Okay, the issue of the DG to delegate the question of security screening, I mean, it is contemplated there that it will be to a senior official, and really it would also what was contemplated here is, for example, that one would allow the DG of SAS to be able to do the foreign affairs security clearances, whereas at the moment it's the DG of NIR that has to sign off on those. But it's not contemplated that it's a junior official. But if you're saying that that's not clear enough, then possibly we need to look at just making that clear. That was the thought process behind that. Just as far as I'll deal with two issues related to the NCC now. The one is the question of the establishment of the NCC as a Schedule 1 department, and then I'll deal with your question, which will require me to deal a little with how we understand the ambit of RICA, and I'll give you some insight into what some of the discussions were around that. Members of the JSCI would certainly be aware
of the fact that the NCC exists currently as an organizational component of the National Intelligence Agency. It has an approved post establishment of 500 and something posts, although about 300 of those have been filled. I can get you the specific specific.
I think the honourable body is correct. So we are almost getting into operational matters now, disclosing national, very key national issues. Perhaps if we just deal with the questions that were put, and then perhaps I can just find it from you. I see you have a document here which actually deals with the way the signals work. I don't know how the members feel. Do they need that presentation now?
No.
Let me get back to you, Mr. Kittens. Can I just hear from the committee? There is a document which we have not had. I just want to hear, before I ask Ms. Carenza to present this, does the committee feel it's necessary to get this presentation on it and how the signals work? I think perhaps at some stage, but perhaps not today, we are going to run out of time. And I think let's leave this document, the one with the signals intelligence, for the committee members to absorb. There are those that are very familiar with the process, and there are a few that are not. I think we'll try and bring those that are not familiar with the process on board, and then perhaps at some later stage we can get a presentation on this. Is that in order, committee members? Mr. Vardy, you still wanted to say something.
Chair, can I just make a suggestion for your consideration? When we're discussing this matter of the NCC, I want to recommend that we consider one or two closed sessions, so that we can have a discussion as members and to get clarity. I'm a bit worried about what has just transpired a little while ago. Because things of structure, etc., whilst it might be in the public domain, I do think that we need to have the opportunity of a more public discussion before we can get down to the nitty-gritty of the amendment. And I think that should be an open process, etc., but I'm a bit concerned that the way in which the discussion is unfolding at the moment. And it's difficult to raise questions and to get clarity on these things. I don't want you to make a decision now. I think you should just consider that, and so that we can work with this one more carefully.
Your point is taken, Donald Vardy, Advocate Swat.
Chair, thank you. Yes, I must just understand, Mr. Vardy, if he talks about a closed session. Does talk about a closed committee? You see, that's my point. Doesn't talk about a closed committee, talks about the JCI. You talk about a closed committee, inclusive of, and you will that. Well, then it's fine.
I think the point was well made. The Honourable Londis?
Yeah, Chair, I want to support Ismail Fadi. Suggestion that he makes. I would imagine it's more a proposal than a suggestion. Firstly, and secondly, we need to just, as in the case of protection of information, I don't know whether we've already done so, but I believe that we ask for the submission of these to do. And is it the intention to do so? If it is, then these are all the things we need to just file. But I thought, I had assumed that today's session was just going to deal with the briefing on the two goals and dealing with queries that may arise.
Thank you, Honourable Londis. Yes, these bills came to us quite late last week, and he did then mention also in our earlier meeting that we would have to accommodate these bills when they get here. So we have tried to make arrangements to put them in, fit them in our program, so of course they're not very extensive. But yes, we will have to consider what you have raised now.
perhaps let us just get Ms. Corenza to finish up on the bill. I think there's an agreement that this document, the signal document, will stand over. The committee members will consider it. There is a concern that we don't transgress, you know, and we'll bring the other members on board as a committee on just how we will deal with the, you know, where the borderlines will be as to what will and will not be disclosed. As you know, the members, particularly of the JSCI, have got an obligation in terms of their vetting process to be more respectable about how they deal with information, and we don't want to have any members get themselves into trouble here. So we'll deal with that as a committee. Can we just have your final presentation on that, and then we'll end the session?
I think the point that I'm trying to make is that the NCC and the budget for the function and for what the NCC does is budgeted for, is approved. There is an existing post establishment, there is an existing budget allocation that at the moment is appropriated through the budgets of the NIA. What will happen once it's established as a department is that it will now be in the same way as it does, but it will be to the NCC. I think members are familiar with the historical reasons for why we are legislating the NCC. As you know, there is a constitutional requirement that all intents and structures need to be established and their mandates set out in law. That is why talking about the functions of the NCC is something that has to be publicly debated. So there will be no immediate costs, Member Gwilym, that will require as a result of the NCC being established as a department. In the Schedule 1 department is a department in terms of the public service, like that's a department of where you have a DG. There obviously are certain obligations that rest on a DG in terms of the PFMA, but within the intelligence environment, as you're aware, there is a shared services center and a shared services board for providing certain administrative functions to the different civilian intelligence components. So we have not anticipated that there will be some financial implications. And possibly in another session, it may be more appropriate to go into some of the historical reasons for why this decision is appropriate now. Just to answer Member Swart's question, perhaps I can just refer to only this diagram when I answer that. Our constitution does not distinguish between the rights of foreigners and the rights of citizens if they are within the borders of the country. So there is no distinction between how we need to approach foreigners or citizens within the borders of the country. And our constitution applies to the rights would apply to people within the borders of the country. As you know, there is a right to privacy, which is why if there is a decision or a need for any law enforcement agency to intercept the communication of an individual, it needs to be done, authorized in terms of international law. And the right to privacy includes the right not to have your communication violated, which is why what happens within the borders of the country is governed by the application of RICA, and in setting out the functions of the NCC, what was required is two things. The first of all is to isolate the application of RICA. What does RICA refer to? And secondly, to conceptually draw a distinction between the interception of communications in a signals intelligence environment and interception of communications provided for in terms of RICA within a domestic environment. environment. And that is why I've given you the handout that shows that internationally, countries make a distinction between how they regulate signals and how they regulate domestic interception. So we've tried conceptually to say this is the border of our country, and that's RICA. Within the border of the country, within the domain of communication, there could be communications that happen outside of the country. And it doesn't matter whether it's a foreigner or it's a South African. They take place on the international communications network. Then there are communications that would start on the foreign communications network, would end in the country, and then there are those that would start in the country, end, and then of course there are those that pass through. We are not looking at what happens within the borders of a country, and we are not looking at calls that are generated from the country, and that is because of the application of RICA. It's really based on a technical appreciation of when RICA says that you can't intercept without a warrant from any place in the borders of the country, what does that mean? I think the other important distinction to make between what happens in a signals intelligence environment and what happens in RICA is that when you intercept in terms of RICA the point A and point B, when you make that application as a law enforcement agency to the judge, you know who that person is, you know who that person is, you know their number, and you know what they're doing. You're either intercepting them because you want to collect evidence, or you're intercepting them because you want to collect intelligence to confirm or refute a specific allegation. Signals intelligence is completely different. You collect signals based on the intelligence priorities of a country. And in another session, it would be more appropriate to give you some details, but I think not in this session. So that is why we've made that decision, and that is why we've excluded calls that are made in the country. Yeah, but the calls that are made outside the country to the country, yes, if it falls within the other criteria of what is an intelligence priority, yes, they would be monitored. But again, the distinction is between specific.
Thank you, Ms. Honourable Members, there we have the presentations. I see you, a number of you are very anxious to escape. I just ask the Honourable Members to just hold on for a minute. There are some issues regarding our program we need clarity on. Let me then just thank the presenters. Ms. Kalenza, thank you very much for your presentation, and Ms. Ndludlo, it was very nice having you here. You've brought clarity to the committee and some value to the understanding of what we're dealing with, and thank you very much for coming to this presentation.
Chairperson, can I just ask, are we required to stay for tomorrow?
I just want to clear this with the committee now. Honourable Members, if you recall the program that was agreed to, and if you just look at it, you'll see that we were going to consider submissions tomorrow from 2 till 5. And then we were also going to meet on Friday from 9 till 13. And then again on Monday from 9 till 5. Friday was going to be from 9 to 1. Before we release the presenters, can we just have some clarity on the position? I might just add that based on the decision taken by the committee, we have extended the deadline for receiving submissions to Friday. And we are still receiving submissions as we sit on a daily basis. A number of people have asked for an extension of time, and we have, per the undertaking and the agreement of the committee, extended that deadline to Friday. So I don't know if that will help the committee members decide as to whether we're going to meet tomorrow and Friday, and whether the program needs to be to be rescheduled. I have the Honourable Swat. Dr. Quinn. The Honourable Vardy. This is just about whether I'm on for this. It's just about the program we're going to meet tomorrow and Friday and Monday as the Green.
Sure, thank you. Well, I think the first question would be, before I get to the rest of this week, the first question would be, the people who made written submissions we already received, have some of them been lined up for oral submissions on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, as we go as we planned? If not, and that's the first question, I think maybe if I can get the answer on that, then I can apply my mind to the rest of this week in terms of the time that we will spend outside of the normal committee hours, and some of us other committees and other obligations to be able to assess and look at what we have before those things. So depend on our full our programs. If you're telling me that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday we're already having oral submissions, then I would say yes. But then probably tomorrow afternoon we should get together and have some discussion about submissions. Although I do not know, except if the discussion of the written submissions as planned was meant for us to decide who we are going to invite to oral. That is the case, yes, then we need to do that. But if it's a case of discussion of the written submission, I mean, that is for each of us by itself to okay. So just some indication as to next week's program, and then maybe I can come back into the loop.
The point I was making earlier, that we are still receiving submissions on a daily basis, and so I think it would be premature now to decide which ones we would invite for oral submissions. Nothing has been done because of that process, because we had agreed to extend the period. And then so while we have received some submissions, a number of very important institutions have indicated that their submissions will only come by Friday.
Sorry, can I just continue on that basis? If that is the case indeed, and those things will be coming, and we can't actually say Friday and not expect that maybe something will come in the envelope on Monday, I would suggest that we cancel all the planned meetings until next Wednesday, when we can say, listen, these are the submissions we have, or Tuesday afternoon, and say these are the people going to invite for oral submissions. But my question then would be, when are we going to do these oral submissions? Because Parliament rises at the end of next week, and then that's it. I mean, then it's constituency work. It's not even committee work until August. Are we moving the whole process 2 weeks further into August, which is not presumably that much of a problem? We can even see this plenary plan for middle of September where we can deal with the debate on this. But I need information to be able to make as to how this will impact on the whole plan program, particularly with reference to July.
Okay, I don't have the answers. Swansea, Honourable Vardy.
Yeah, thank you very much. I want to suggest that we cancel the scheduled meeting for tomorrow, Friday, and Monday. But secondly, so far I have received, I think, 4 or 5 submissions from different organizations, and there might be 1 or 2 from individuals or something. I don't think it's necessary for us as a committee to go to each one of those. Those are meant for our own reading, for us to get an understanding of what we are saying. What I want to suggest is that we take a decision today to hold public hearings, either next Wednesday or Thursday, set aside the whole day, and invite all of the people who have given us, if they are organizations, not individuals, if they are organizations and they've given us submissions, we should invite them, and that we give you and the administration the task of just programming it 20 minutes slot per institution, not to read the whole text, but to take us through some of the salient points, so that it helps for an airing of views, etc. But that we must get the hearings done, the public hearings done by next week. Otherwise, it's going to take us early into August, and I think it's going to become very difficult then to manage this. But this is a substantial bulk. There's a lot of issues, and I think the committee needs more time for itself to go through the bill in detail. And August should be there for that, for careful work on the bill. So that's really my recommendation, that we schedule the hearings next week and we go ahead.
I come from a very deep party, you know, where we do almost everything. So, Monday, of course, like the problem of Parliament is constituency work. And one already has song arranged time. So, for Monday, you can rule me out. In fact, all Mondays, there's going to be anything on Monday. Take into account that from where we come from, some of us, we are the big weeks of parties, so we meet on every Monday on other things and then go out. Then on Friday, this week, unfortunately, I won't be there too. Thank you.
The Honorable Dr.
Clark. Well, I think we're more or less on the same wavelength. I don't think there's any separate ready for the meeting tomorrow. I'm not even sure of a meeting for hearings next week because we've not received the submission. We've received a bulk of letters asking for extension until the 20th. And all the organizations, they are complaining that it's a complicated deal, they need time. And we've agreed to that extension. I think we may have to rejuggle our program a bit and maybe try and prioritize the bills to deal with the bills which are not controversial like this one. And postpone the issue of hearing. And maybe next week deal with the submission, but with maybe a smaller committee on Tuesday, deal with the submission and present something on Wednesday. These are the categories of the submission, so that we can see where there are differences in the committee. But maybe continue on Wednesday to get any clarity whether we close it or open it on these other bills. Because I don't think that they'll be difficult. But the sooner we take a decision on these two other bills, whether we want submissions on them or not, it helps us to move forward. Because my main worry is that if we say now we're calling for hearing, you must at least give people at least a week prepared to come to Cape Town. Otherwise, you will find those who have got private jets that will come to your hearings. And our aim was to open this thing to broader society and organizations not necessarily rich. And some of those are not necessarily rich. Even those who are rich, they just asked for this extension. So I won't really rush this legislation. I think there's also the understanding even from the minister that they're not expecting us to. That's right. I'm not saying we must delay for the sake of delay. Because of the nature of it, my suggestion, if I can be concrete, that a small committee, multi-party committee, look at the submissions on Tuesday. So they present a summary, and then the committee can decide then whom to be invited to make oral submission, and give those people at least a week minimum, so they can prepare to come to Cape Town. It would be unfair to just say, come tomorrow. That's my main worry, because we did give the extension. But I really suggest that if we need to call for submission, I think it may be on the NCC. I'm not sure, maybe we're guided by the ministry, whether there were any submissions from the public on these other bills. Because to me, these are the bills which really require our consideration more than the public interest, really, in terms of this. Except that this one which deals with the interception, bulk interception, or signals intelligence, we may need to get hit problem. That's the only one I think we may have to maybe listen or give people if they wish. Maybe a week or two, because it's something which deals with the rights of the people. The other deal, really, I think we should continue with it and getting further briefings and then later on consideration. The only one we may have to consider giving a limited access to people to comment is this one. I think the members, particularly today, they know the problems we've had at the NCC. And I'm not sure whether the bill covers all those aspects of protection, particularly, of the signal intelligence being abused. Because I think at the end of the day, what motivated this was to prevent any possible abuse of the signal intelligence. So that is my contribution. A short one, that we don't have a meeting tomorrow, we go and start the building. Two, on Tuesday and Monday, we don't call a meeting, we go to our constituencies. Three, on Tuesday, a small multi-party committee considers all the submissions which should have come by the 20th and make recommendations to the committee on Wednesday. And additionally, on Wednesday, we further consider the smaller bill, what is it? The amendment bill. Yes. But we must take a decision whether are we calling the submission on the NCC now or not. Yeah. So, but we have to take the decision whether we need it or not. Thanks.
When are you proposing?
I said on this one, we must, after receiving those submissions and considering, we must at least give them a reasonable period, at least a week, for people to come and make presentations in Cape Town. Because people have to book, they have to have transport, we have to see whether they need our assistance and all those things. Otherwise, if we shorten that period because we are pressed by the parliamentary program or we don't want to sit during recess, we may find that we're squeezing some of the people may be valuable, may have a valuable input, but may not have the means to act expediently.
Thank you, Dr. Clever. Is there anybody else, the Honourable London?
Chair, yes, I deliberately deferred to Dr. Clever because I had an idea that those are the proposals we're going to make and I want to support them. And go one further and propose that we actually request submissions for the bill that deals with the NCC. That we mandate you and the staff, you know how that's done. But everything set out by Dr. Quinn is fine, same with me, for the reasons that he put forward.
Okay, something more, sorry.
Chair, well, it's easy to say that. Parliament rises next Friday. Nothing to commit doing into constituency work. Some of us have arranged meetings where people are coming from various places and rural areas. We've got specific programs. I'm not saying it's unadjustable. All I'm saying is you can't really expect members of parliament who rises on Friday to wait until next Wednesday to find out if the next Monday they have to be back here and Tuesday and Wednesday or not, or what the case may be. We need to take decisions here, I think, just to be fair. Because in the same way, we might as well spend another hour here, look at some of the submissions we already received, like the Ministerial Review Commission, Open Democracy Advice Center, FXI, and we can already decide they are coming in any case. If we decide for public hearings, we can inform them this afternoon, and we can already line up a whole day of public hearings for next Thursday, for instance, which will give them a week time. They already know that the program is next week, so most of the, you understand what I'm saying? My concern is just wait until next Wednesday, and then we say, okay, but now we're going to have public hearings next Wednesday. On the Wednesday after that, but then someone said, no, I can't be there, I can only be there the Monday after that. And then you're moving into the middle of a thing that's... I just think it's fair that we do not have some indications what are we indeed planning on what dates we're going to have the public hearings. Otherwise, we might postpone them until the end of July.
Honourable members, I've heard you now. There is a question that we have advertised that the public hearings will take place next week. So I think that even those that are late with their presentations that be given an extension of time must be aware that the public hearings was scheduled for next week. But let's just get some of the things out of the way. I think there's consensus there will be no meeting tomorrow and there will be no meeting on Friday.
And
I was going to revisit Monday, but I hear I'm overwhelmed and Monday. So that leaves us now with Tuesday and Wednesday and the question of the public hearings that have been advertised. means now we're going to have to re-advertise. I just want to canvass with you, it's not my view, just canvass. Look at Advocate Swartz's view. Is there no substance in what he's saying that we should notify some of those people already that they can be heard on Wednesday or Tuesday? That we can hear them on Wednesday. We can, even if it's the whole day, we can sit the whole day, I'm sure. We know who we, you know, there are a number of them that are favorites for oral hearings, and there are a number of them that I think we can settle with the written submissions. I just wanted to hear the members on that before we make a final decision. The Honorable Doctor.
I hope you do that. I've read those submissions. They carry the same view from two groups of people. Media and media-related people and lawyers. And my main worry is that this bill is not applicable to media and lawyers, but applicable to people working in the department and South Africa. So while we may have to rush and deal with the lawyers and the media people, we may miss a bigger component of civil society to which this law is also applicable. So that's my main worry, that if you check some of those submissions, one and the same person having another, a different cover letter. You see? I can give you an example of that. I've shown you today. But I don't know how to do it today.
I'm familiar with your complaint.
Yeah, I'm just trying to say the submissions we've had so far, they are useful, but they are limited to a certain extent. And we must take that into account.
Can I just hear the Honourable Quelle on the issue? There will be presentations coming in up until Friday. Assuming there are a number of or a range of new people that have presented, is it the Honourable Member's view that notwithstanding that the hearing shouldn't take place? If we were able to arrange with those people that they would present next week oral representations on the bill, would that still be a problem in terms of rushing the thing, or would the Honourable Trailer still feel that the thing needs to be, the program needs to be redesigned?
I'm not saying it should be postponed at all costs. I was just looking at practical. Remember, Shepherd's and first meeting, we mandated you to specifically write certain organizations. And I've not had seen any one of those organizations make a submission yet. But I'm not saying that if all come with clear submissions by Friday, you should postpone just for the sake of postponing. I was just raising the practical aspect of it, that we need to give a fair chance, because I've read that some of those responses, they're all complaining. They're giving us short time, this thing is complicated. That's a common trend. But if you get everything, we'll leave it to the committee.
I think we've got the answer. So I think just listen to understand. Look, the honourable members, I think what we've established, there'll be no further meeting this week. We expect all these presentations to come in by Friday. I understand from Dr. Quelle what he's saying is there will be a meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday. Shall we then perhaps not agree that we will look at these submissions and review the situation with some of these organizations to see whether they are ready to present oral submissions on Tuesday or Wednesday next week? If you perhaps...
The key issue here
is
that you have to give them notice. See,
the point I'm making is that if they are prepared, given those ones, because it's for the committee to decide which ones will be given the opportunity to make oral submissions.
Yes, but I thought Dr. Quelle was saying that we would do that on Tuesday.
Question I'm putting now is that if by Friday we've received all these submissions, should we not if there are these organizations that are in a position to present on Tuesday and Wednesday, should that not be taken into account? I just want to make sure that we have that's something we're not going to consider. Leon?
No, Chair, what I understand now is that, look, we don't have the range of submissions that we desire. We're going to wait till Friday that will come in. Next week, Tuesday, a small working team will go through those and identify who we will be inviting to do all the presentations to us. Realistically, those hearings can only be scheduled sometimes either during the constituency period, that is by agreement of the parties, or it will be in the first week in August when it is a committee meeting. I think that's the realistic plan, and we must accept it. So, and I really think that we must schedule just one day for hearing. Don't drag the thing on for long, long presentations. People must come with this focused presentation. Give them a 30-minute slot for the organization, whatever it is. Finish it in a day. And then we must get on with our work. But realistically, from what I can sense now, is that it will really be either the end of July or the first week in August that we're looking for the hearing. But it cannot, I think it can't be done by next week. We've got to be for the hearing.
Is that the final proposal? Is that the proposal of the committee? Any objection?
Mark, I mean, I ask you specifically in terms of whatever happened, we will not change the July program. Last week, and you said that, and of course, it's not a specific arrangement. I mean, some of that even out of the country. Can I suggest, at the moment, the program indicates that on the 29th of July, we will spend the day discussing the bill. It will be our first day of discussion. Is that correct? So I don't have my program in front of me. It's just a little bit like that.
Yeah.
Whatever we decide, if you just give me the assurance that you will not move into the 28th of July. That's all I'm asking. Because I will be in flight on the 28th of July and I will not be available. That is based on what you assured me last week.
The 28th is a Monday.
Yeah.
There's a lot of opposition to meeting on a Monday.
No, that's all I'm saying, Jay. All I'm saying. Then we can talk. So let's do the next Tuesday and sort out. Because I've got no problem that if we take 2 days off public hearings, what we're going to do, we're going to move our parliamentary program of 2 days further until we get to the print.
Okay, I think we understand one another now. So those people, those members that want to participate in the, can the secretary get hold of you to find out if you are willing to participate in that smaller group on Tuesday? Okay, we've had Okay, honourable members, that's the end of the meeting. Miss, sorry for keeping you. You've heard there's going to be no presentation this week.
Yeah.